Joan is here, so then we can start properly. Welcome, Joan. The three chairs have met, and we've exchanged through emails, and this is a program we decided on to explain that our feeling is, and I think you'll largely agree, that we cannot go around in circles. We've had about four joint meetings. We have very ambitious ideas about meeting once every quarter. It's not possible. And so what we're moving towards, and regrettably, and I must take major responsibility, the last item, I was supposed to have helped to draft a document together with Comrades Joan and Zed Luzipo, who will be here shortly, and put it to the committee to consider. But given a variety of circumstances that hasn't happened, it's really towards 1440, and earlier if possible, but the last, second to last item, that we're directing this meeting. In other words, Comrade Joan, just come in when you want, right? I'll just summarize. What we are saying is, we can't meet four times a year in the C committee. Furthermore, we've got eight committees that are meant to meet. So what we are suggesting is that we meet once a year as eight committees, and twice a year as three committees. But in the meanwhile, as finance is doing, we insert in our program of the respective committees we have issues around illicit financial flows as they apply to our respective portfolios, even though we realize it's overlapping. So for example, what we have done is like every time SARS comes before us, or every time we have a DTA, double tax agreement, we ask, how is this tackling illicit financial flows and aggressive tax avoidance and so on, right? So similarly, minerals will deal with the minerals issues around illicit financial flows. As you know, most mineral economies are very vulnerable to base erosion and profit shifting and aggressive tax avoidance and tax evasion. So this is where we're moving towards. And at the last meeting, members expressed frustration, having looked mainly at the Panama Papers, that besides some words uttered by Treasury and to some extent FIC, nothing much seems to be getting done. What emerged at that meeting, you'll recall, in a roundabout way, because each of these institutes is very careful about what it says that might have implications for other institutions, right? So what emerged to us, as we summarized it at the end, was that there's a feeling that SAPS does not act when issues are referred to it by the FIC or whoever. Not that the FIC said that, let me stress. Secondly, even if the SAPS does act, if it's got expertise and skills and necessary resources, then the NPA doesn't have it. So we said, fine, let's get the SAPS committee and the Justice Committee, and we spoke to the two chairs concerned, and they said, no, it's a very good idea. We should go ahead, they will consider our report, and they'll insert it into their programs. So SAPS, your committee, will every quarter ask you, what are you doing about illicit financial flows and money laundering, right? And the non-legal or illegal side of base erosion and profit shifting. We're asking SARS that next week when they're here, okay? Then trade and industry will, Matole said to me, no, he agrees. So when NPA, I see Willie Hoffmeyer, I welcome you and your team. Who's here from SAPS? Ah, there you are, sir. You want to introduce yourself quickly? Your committee chairperson, Duke Mann, has been in, we've been in touch five times at least in the last 3 weeks, and he says, no, of course, he too will do it. So, in other words, we work in separate programs and a collective one, okay? So, what I'm saying in short is, I note your hand, but we just doing our job here, reporting on where we are and what we'd like to do and then hear what you have to say. So basically, what we are saying is, at the end of the last meeting, the members generally expressed frustration that there's no obvious deterrence. You can do these things and get away with it. Even the Panama Papers, there's no progress, we don't know what's going on. Right? So that is more or less the thrust of today's meeting as we see it. And then we will, within two, three weeks, certainly before the first next quarter, give you a draft aspects of strategy and program. And then you will finalize that when we meet again, maybe briefly, let's say towards the end of May, the three committees meet for about half an hour and say, this is the draft program and the strategy. What do we think? That's the direction, right? Okay, over to you, John.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think you've really summarized the process so far. And in fact, trade and industry have a particular interest. We're anxious to see this matter concluded because, as everyone knows, the Standing Committee on Finance is the only committee that has the constitutional authority to take a money bill through Parliament. So we do depend on the Standing Committee of Finance to take this up. And we were very happy to hear that the Minister of Finance, in his budget speech now, this has happened on three occasions, has referred directly to transfer pricing and base erosion and committed the Ministry, the Department, to expediting this matter. So this is where we are. And we see this meeting as a milestone in getting there. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay, just one final item of information. There's a global tax transparency network of committees that deal with tax issues globally. It had a conference in December for a day. They invited the Chair of Finance to officially open it together with a British host. The reason they obviously asked me to go is not because of my looks. It's because they recognize that we are crucial to this fight. And in fact, we are one of the 10 worst countries when it comes to the figures that are available for illicit financial flows. And I must tell you, we did the report in the Finance Committee. As you know, when chairs go on behalf of a committee, they report back and just noted it's not adopted. But we adopted the statement of the 46, I think, countries or so that were present there. This global network, regrettably, is once again, like most of these, dominated by people in the advanced industrialized world. I can tell you this, it was quite a fight to get them to acknowledge that they have to take into account some of the peculiarities and sensitivities and needs of developing countries, particularly on our continent. And that there are certain things they might want to do that serve their own interests as advanced industrialized economies, but may militate against ours. So we tried to get the conference to be held here this December, but of course there are financial and other implications to it, and I'm working with the chairperson of her committee's oversight and the chairperson of International Relations and Speaker's Office to see if we can't host the conference here in December. It's a one-day conference. The report will be distributed. It's just for noting. But what we would like other committees to note is that on page 12 or whatever, the Annexure A, there is actually a statement that members of Parliament at that conference agreed to. And we voted on it in our committee last week, and I meant to write to the Minister of Finance. It calls for multinational companies to declare their profits, their assets, the number of people they employ in every country where they're involved, so that there's transparency about the tax that they pay, so that not only members of governments, but members of parliament, and very crucially, citizens, are aware of what these countries are doing. Are they delivering taxes or paying taxes where they produce value? So that is being distributed in a moment. If it hasn't been done, the Finance Committee's process, that matter, it's really for noting. But we would like to draw your attention, and we'd like this committee to consider, all three of us, one of us, to adopt that call on the governments to ensure that the multinationals in their respective countries are accounting for the value they produce and the tax they pay proportionate to that value. So there we are, and we're trying to get this thing to expand it beyond committees that deal with tax to drawing in, for example, the Mining Committee, Trade and Industry Committee, and so on. That too is a battle, but that's a different issue that we can address at some other time. So that briefly is where we're reporting back on where we were last year and where we are now seeking to go, and secondly, providing you the broad framework for today's discussion, which is going to be a very business-like meeting, but there we are. Okay, over to members of, what's his name, Floyd, you had your hand up. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so there we are. We will share as we do. One of us is afflicted with a flu, but the last stages, so it won't be inflicted on any of you. Can we start then with National Treasury? Tell us, You've seen, the reports have been sent out to all committee members at 12:51 on Thursday last week to finance members, and later that afternoon to other members. So you've got it, and we sent out again yesterday. Is that right, Alan? Yes. So everybody's got it, and we've given the reports to everybody here. They've seen the program, so they're very clear. People still asked yesterday, astonishingly, what do you want us to come and do? I cannot tell you how more concrete a program you can have. It's clear here and clear from our reports. So you know what is required of you, National Treasury. Can you give us 5 minutes each a report? We're going to monitor you with the stopwatch, right? Thank you.
Yeah, I hope your stopwatch is accurate, Chair. Sometimes I think it runs too fast, but anyway.
I'm just joking.
Chair, no, thank you for this. I think as Treasury, we really welcome these hearings. And in fact, we want to say, I think the last time we met was last year, May, and a lot has happened since then. In fact, I think I've become much wiser, and if we now had to do things, I would do them slightly differently. And I think we'd welcome that today, really, we don't focus on policy. Yes, there are things to do in policy, get the FICA bill through. We need to do regulations, we need to deal with beneficial ownership. A lot of those things are important, and we'll put those things in place. I think we would like the focus to be today on what actually is our capacity to deal with financial crimes when we identify them. And I want to give you an example when I say much has happened. I think certainly we know about Panorama and BAPS, okay? And certainly there's presentations on those that we have in the, from SARS and others. But, you know, let's take the Oa Tambo cash heist 2 weeks ago. Now, I sit there, I know as much information as you, okay? But the questions for me come to mind. Why is actual cash being transferred? Is it not electronic? It could be that it's a bank that needs to take money to a country where they need dollars or so. So it could be legitimate. But we need to know, is it legitimate or not? What's the role of customs? What's the role of the FIC? What's the role of SARS? Okay. Is the SEP stalking to these agencies? Okay. Is there effective communication? So these are just questions. I just say, I think now where I sit, I realize, and with regulators, everybody needs to have a curious mind. If our regulators aren't reading newspapers and so on from social media, and their only response is, we can't do anything until somebody lays charges, frankly, we'll make no progress on illicit flows. Okay, I'll give you other examples. We see a lot on money being taken to Dubai. Do we watch every plane that goes out to Dubai? You know, when you go to America, not only, I know that they check for, you know, that you don't do certain bad things, but does someone actually check for cash? Because just talking to our customs colleagues and SARS, they'll tell you, we might be focusing on what comes in, but are we focused on what goes out beyond, obviously, the things that bring harm, your metal detectors and so on. But when paper goes through, what happens? Is somebody watching? Okay. Bank accounts are closed. Is anybody, you know, we can't get the information from the FIC. Are the relevant authorities going and asking, what do you do? What's happening? Why was it closed? Is there frustration that when things are reported, nothing seems to happen? So for me, the issue is, how much is information shared between the authorities? If, let's say, the SARB reports to the prosecuting authorities or to the enforcement authorities. Some of it, there's regulatory problems that, you know, that they cannot tell the person who reports what the outcome of any investigation would be. But do they report to anybody on it? Do they report to Parliament? Because we don't get statistics. Nothing. Okay. Do they even exist? So, I don't know, I ask lots of questions. Let me tell you, as we sit as a Treasury, we hear reports that mining rehab funds may or may not have been affected. Firstly, what do I do as an official?
meeting. We just got a message from Minerals that have an urgent meeting simultaneously, but they'll be here shortly. Okay.
So I wish they would hear, because I would like them to ask these questions in Parliament. I said there is an official. I will write to SARS, to FIC, to everyone and say, listen, this is in the newspapers. This is in the Minister's Court papers. This is in a certificate. Are you sure the rehab funds have not been raided? If they've been raided, SARS can impose not only the 28%, but a penalty of a further 56%. Has SARS got that money? SARS is not allowed to tell me because it's taxpayer confidentiality. But I want to record that we've told SARS that, so that if one day it's known that they haven't collected, they can be held to account. The question is, how do you hold people to account? I hope the Auditor General is looking at this, okay? Because I don't have to tell you, not only do we fail to collect the revenue, assuming that's not done.
5 minutes. Can I plead with the committee? Can't we give them an extra 2 minutes? Because Treasury is crucial, right? So we're giving an extra two
Thank
minutes.
Thank you. Okay. So the question is, if that money is gone, the responsibility will be on the fiscus to spend, so it could be a double whammy. Chair, the way our current system is, Treasury cannot give you the answers, and neither can the agencies. But we've got to find some mechanism where the info at least gets reported, whether it's in the aggregate or not. I think further, it does get to the question of what is the capacity of our enforcement agencies, because part of the problem is, even if the person is jailed, it doesn't mean that they jail under, let's say, the anti-money laundering laws. Now, it's something that we are engaging with the NPA and others. We've started an engagement. But I do think that we need to look at these issues, because just to remind everyone, the issue of the issue here is, how effective are we in implementing current laws? There's little point in having new laws if you're not obviously doing it. Chair, we also see other risks. When I take up the issue of the Border Management Agency, we need to look at this. The risk will increase. They will not decrease. And Treasury has been clear. We are unhappy with fragmenting customs admin and customs collection. We've said it. Okay? It's a risk. Up to 25% of our revenue, but the bigger risk is fragmentation and so on. And the bigger issue, we think, is what is the coordination between our agencies? How can we improve the system whereby they can report to us, either as Parliament, as government, so that we know that our regulators are awake and on the job? We do not have that. And I think when you deal with illicit flows, this is obvious, and I'm saying these are big newspaper items, and we cannot say whether monies have been raided and taken out or not as a department. Doesn't mean the other authorities don't know, but they may not be allowed to tell us. How do we deal with those issues? So we are very happy that we're focusing on enforcement, and we think if we don't make progress against those issues, if we can't answer those questions, then we're not serious in a fight against illicit flows. Thank you.
Can you give us, although I know you've done it in a point bullet form, can you give us the text so that the report that's written by the content advisors takes into account what you're saying and attaches it, so that next time we don't cover the same ground, because Webers will have been referred to your documentation. SARS, where are you? Ah, yes. You again.
Me again, yes, Chair. So, Chair, if I may, you'll notice the presentations you have in front of them are broken up by customs, BEPS, and Panama Papers, one of which fits very neatly into the program. The other two sort of spread themselves across. So if I could beg your indulgence, and if we could start with the customs, because that speaks very clearly to the kinds of statistics and interactions that have happened with respect to report on progress. And then under improving capacity, we can do BEPS, which will then also report back on some progress, but which will have a much greater focus on the building of capacity, if that would be acceptable. So I'll hand over to my customs colleagues on the first.
Okay, if you kindly just introduce yourself and your position.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson and the members. I'm William Mpye from Customs. Compliance Risk and Case Selection. That's my title. Thanks. May I continue? Thanks. Next slide, thanks. So this slide just talks to the problem that we discovered recently on what we call advanced import payments. Next slide, thanks. So what we discovered as we were doing our work is that certain companies or even certain individuals do simulated imports into the country, perhaps for the sake of taking money outside the country. And they use legitimate processes through the banks, but the intention basically is to take money out of the country. In this regard then, thanks, the next slide. The advance import payments, as I said, it's a legitimate process that allows importers, manufacturers and the like to be able to do their work or do their manufacturing without interruption in their processes as such. And they can then order their materials or whatever that they want to import into the country up front and pay up front for whatever that they want to import. And by the time the materials come into the country, then they kind of acquit through the Reserve Bank system what has come into the country. So the money that they send out, they acquit against the imports that would have come into the country. So some companies, some individuals will send money out to simulate those imports and pretend that they're importing something. And through our work, we discovered that this is a little bit prevalent in certain industries or with certain individuals. And we started clamping down on that particular activity. In an attempt to clamp down on that activity, next slide, thanks, we approached authorized dealers of foreign currency as well as banks that deal in that market to get a sense and a list of transactions that hasn't been closed. So money that has been sent outside of the country on the pretext that they are importing something. Some of it is legitimate, by the way. It is money that has been sent legitimately. But all of all of those transactions, which ones have gone beyond their allowable period after the period has expired to close those transactions. Of the 25 that we approached, authorized dealers, 14 of them provided us with a list of those unclosed transactions. And then we tested those transactions and we found about 66,000 of them transactions that had no proof of importation. So as I said earlier on, after importing or after sending the money out, you then close the transaction with documents that shows that the import has generally come into the country. So of this 66,000, we couldn't find any proof that any imports have certainly come into the country. Of the 66,000 transactions, the money that we're dealing with, and as I'm saying, some of the 66,000 is actually genuine transactions. So all of it, all in all, money that was transferred was about 34 billion rand, or that was paid over to suppliers outside of the country, was about 34 billion rand. This is the first time that we step across this. So we needed then to run a pilot or a test case to determine the extent of the problem itself. So we took a few transactions of these, and as I said, tested them to understand what the prevalence of this is. We then took 81 of these importers across the spectrum.
Here again, we're at 5:25. Can we just let people speak for about seven and a half minutes, man? Because I think we need more information before we decide what to do, right? So it's fine.
Thank you. Thanks, sir. So then we then tested out of the number of importers that we had in our hands. We tested about 81 cases of them. And then 61 of them we have finalized so far. And out of those, we have raised cases or schedules, what we call in customs languages schedules, of about out of that we raised against 45 cases, and those 45 cases amounted to about 220 million rand, and so far we've collected about 172 million rand of that money. And then out of the rest of those, there were extra importers that we had kind of investigated, and we found in this instance, in that four that we're talking about in particular, separate to the import advance import payment group, there was about four of them that we determined that they had done what we call ghost exports as such, okay, ghost imports in actual fact. And those, it's for us, it's pure fraud, and those cases we have sent them for a criminal investigation inside of SARS, not as yet to NPA as well as SAPS, but within SARS we've got a unit that will check deeper and understand exactly what the transaction was all about, and our colleagues in SARS in criminal investigations are still busy with those cases. Thanks. Next slide. Chairperson, separate to what we've done in terms of advanced import payments, there's also an aspect on the custom side, not necessarily on the tech side, of transfer pricing. And transfer pricing on the custom side has to do, and this looks to a certain extent across the outlined, both from a custom side and a tax side of the business. But this time around, you will find that these are multinationals that would have adjusted their statements before publishing those statements, and for them to be able to achieve the required profit margins, then they would change their numbers accordingly, so that they can reflect a better profit in their numbers. Thank you. I'll round up. So out of those, the next slide. Out of those, we approached about 54 of those lines, and we determined that out of 54, there's about 22 of them that had done transfer pricing, and out of those, we collected about 70 million rand. And what we've done, just to make it easy for us to handle these cases further, in future, we have adjusted our forms, what we call ITR 14 form, for companies, for them to indicate in their statements when they do their returns to indicate whether they have done any adjustments in their statements before they publish those statements. And in future, then it will be easy for us to do that. Thanks, Chair.
The text, you can browse through it as we proceed. Next is the FIC. Mr. Mitchell is here. Text for the FIC, you'll have received it now.
Chair, thanks very much. I am going to stick within my time, Chair, I hope, I trust. Join Chair. Chair, I'm going to run through the slides very quickly and skip a number of them. You'll have copies, all members will have copies. Yeah, so some of the backgrounds. But I want to just emphasize a couple of quick points here, because quite often there's a misperception of what the FIC does or is able to do and what it's not able to do. And the first thing here is that the task is to identify proceeds of crime. In other words, the FIC is looking for illegality as opposed to issues such as mispricing, transfer pricing, and so on. We're focusing on the hardcore illegality. And when it comes to the Mbeki high-level report, the ECA report, it's that 35% category that falls within the criminality sphere. So that would be the area of our focus in relation to the IFF's chair. Moving on then, I just want to point out in the last financial year for which we have audited figures, 2015-2016, some 34,000 institutions, entities, and business are registered with the FIC. That would include a number of, obviously, all the banking institutions and so on, but also lawyers, estate agents, and so on, many of whom would be accused of being party to illicit financial flows in one form or another. So they register with the FIC, therefore have an obligation to comply with the legislation and have an obligation to report to the FIC. In the last financial year, 9.5 million reports were made to the FIC in various forms. Obviously, a lot of that is not illegal in any way. It could be absolutely legitimate transactions, but it gets reported because it gets picked up. And out of that process of analysis, 2,490 products, financial intelligence products, were then transferred or disseminated to our law enforcement partners for action. So that just gives you a sense of the extent of our work and what has moved into the law enforcement environment. We then, and let me just move on then, Chair, to actions on Panama Papers, what we have done in the period since we were last here. We've certainly analyzed all the information that we've been given, had available to us. That included engagement with our counterparts in Panama for any additional information they're able to provide or not. And then, as a result of that analysis, all the relevant information was transferred to law enforcement. So we're happy that all of that has been adhered to and has gone through to the appropriate agencies and so on. We then also did a compliance check of a couple of institutions that have been named and were apparent in the Panama Papers, institutions functioning in South Africa. Inspections were conducted of them. Those inspections included participation of the Law Society and the Financial Services Board. So you can deduce from that which particular sectors were involved there. And to emphasize that there were no transgressions or compliance transgressions found in relation to the Panama Papers themselves. There were a couple of other issues related to FIC non-compliance, but that's a slightly different issue. So there were no issues found there, but obviously it's something that we continue to monitor, and in terms of compliance, generally it's something that is always a concern for us. Chair, in terms of improving capacity, we continue as we are. There's a cap on our capacity, both in terms of budget and staffing, so we sit where we've always been. There are a couple of issues that need to be followed up, in particular interdepartmental relations side. We are concerned about the issue of beneficial ownership and shareholder information. That's contained in the FIC Amendment Bill. We are already engaged in trying to ensure that relevant departments are able to work with us for the implementation of the bill when it goes through and gets signed off. In particular there, the Department of Trade and Industry, and in relation, and especially the CIPC. At the same time, the Master's Office and around issues of trust formation, the Department of Justice Correctional Services there. So that's one area that we need to focus on, and it's very important for all issues of transparency that will arise in the course of the discussion today. The second issue is that of cash declarations. It's already been picked up in SARS Customs and Treasury. It's how to make sure that monies moving across borders are declared. There has been, and there's a section of the FIC Act which has never been promulgated in relation to this particular matter. And that's always been because of the need for one or other of the agencies to take responsibility for all the ports of entry and exit, and the ability to deal with this matter. And when we talk about cash declaration, it's not just about declaring, it's about seizing cash, it's about reporting that information through to the FIC and the other agencies, and then it's also pursuing the investigation and dealing with the evidence, which has always been a problem in the past. We have been working with the Border Management Agency and workshopping with them to work out a modus operandi and how we get this thing effected over the next period. There are differences between them and Treasury, as we know, they're public, as to how to manage this on the customs side, but that's certainly something that we are looking at. And then, Chair, something that's in an earlier slide that's not here. We're working closely with projects initiated by the National Director of Public Prosecutions and run by the AFU and the NPA around creating a task team to deal with financial crime and, as a consequence, illicit financial flows. That's already beginning to make progress, and I'm sure that my colleagues from both SARB and NPA will be able to talk to that. So in a nutshell, Chair, that's where we are. Thank you very much.
Other items, but fine. You don't have to speak if you don't care to. Next is DTI. Who's here from DTI?
It's me.
Ah, there you are.
Okay, my name is Desmond Ramabrana from the Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division within the DTI. What I'm just here to report, maybe I'll just take a few, just a very few minutes, maybe less than 5 minutes, because I saw here that even the FIC have already covered a lot on one of the projects that we are working hand in hand with them. And that project is the project of beneficial ownership. What we are doing is that we administer the Companies Act. So we are part of an interdepartmental committee with the Department of Public Service and Administration and other departments, in that we have got to see to it that our legislations have got a clear a definition and a clear regulation of disclosures when it comes to beneficial owners, when it comes to shareholding of a particular entity. So what we are currently doing is that we, with our agency, which is the CIPC, have already set in to see as to how can we amend our Companies Act to comply. So what we've done now is that currently now we're working on the regulations, because our Companies Act is on the process of being amended. So it is on the next parliamentary calendar. So, but before that, there has to be at least a measure in which maybe we can change at least the regulation, because we have got a provision that allows the minister by regulation to take certain steps just to address certain interim things that do not have maybe to wait for the current legislation. So we are busy in setting making sure that beneficial ownership requirements become part of the requirements that companies must comply with when they file their annual returns. So we are on that one. So we are busy working with FIC, and we are trying to relate our acts with the FATF recommendation, which is a certain international body that deals with the keeping of illicit financial flows in that regard. So we are working on that one. So the other area that we deal with is the area of gambling. On gambling, we did have a standpoint that in that online gambling is not allowed in South Africa. In fact, online gambling, we have already advised and we have already legislated that online gambling is not allowed, and that all illegal winnings that maybe can flow from online gambling, if possible, maybe the Reserve Bank must block those winnings. But that is on the illegal gambling side. We are also involved in issues like out of intellectual property when it comes to, and also in issues of counterfeit goods, where we do liaise with border police on those matters. One of the projects that we were even engaged on, which we didn't have an opportunity to report, was on the project that was dealing with small businesses. Because normally, in the beginning, it was the mandate of the DTI to deal with this issue of rewriting the Small Businesses Act. What happened was that it was just to cap in the issues where you find that maybe there are foreigners and refugees who by law are allowed maybe to conduct businesses for survival while they are in the country. But we didn't have actual laws that could maybe harmonize and protect that. At least our small businesses must be protected in that area. So we were busy coming with the legislation just to rewrite the whole Businesses Act, to just to allow municipalities to be able to account for all the role players and all the businesses that were in municipalities. But since now the Small Business Department has been formed, the whole legislation has been handed over to the small businesses. But we are working with them on all issues where they need to be to be helped, because we were the ones who did consultations and we were the ones involved in policies around these issues. So that is what I can report so far.
Reserve Bank.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Thijs Persoon from the Financial Surveillance Department of the South African Reserve Bank. It's also used to be known as the Exchange Control Department, just to make sure that everybody knows where we're coming from. The department regulates and monitors. The department regulates, monitors cross-border foreign exchange transactions to prevent the abuse of the financial system and to support the regulation of our financial institutions from a prudential point of view. Next slide, please. We have certain powers under the exchange control regulations to investigate illicit foreign currency transactions. And we can also implement certain actions, including the blocking of funds, attachment of money and assets, the forfeiture of such assets and money to the state, and obviously the referral of these matters to law enforcement. Next slide, please. We have certain systems at our disposal, and I think the most important one is the reporting system. All foreign cross-border transactions are reported to the Financial Surveillance Department by the authorized dealers and the authorized dealers with limited authority. That enables us to trace transactions, obviously, and if you can trace a transaction, you can track it. We also have import verification and export systems where we use data supplied by customs to monitor and authenticate import and export transactions. There's a system used, the Online Risk Manager, for investigation purposes. Next slide, please. From information sharing point of view, obviously all information is shared within the ambit of the current laws. We provide the cross-border transaction data to SARS on all import-export transactions. Similar cross-border transaction data is provided to the FIC. We also receive data from SARS from a customs perspective on goods cleared both import and export-wise. We do accept requests for information from various agencies, including SARS, the FIC, law enforcement, and we obviously do refer matters to these agencies as we do our investigations. Next slide, please. We have implemented certain measures to enable us to detect, deter, and disrupt illicit financial flows. Firstly, enhanced mining and analysis of our cross-border data, which enable us to detect suspicious trends and activities. There's a continual enhancement of our financial intelligence. We build case files based on previous investigations, modus operandi, identifying certain high-risk categories of transactions or even suspicious entities. Next slide. Obviously, within the South African Reserve Bank, we engage with our colleagues, specifically in the Bank Supervision Department, when we do, from time to time, do joint inspections at the authorized dealers. I've covered the information sharing with other agencies, SARS, FIC, law enforcement, the NPA, including the Asset Forfeiture Unit. And I think our colleagues from the FIC has mentioned, we do participate in a task team, multi-agency task team, which will target certain specific cases to enable us to fully investigate not only the foreign exchange leg, but every other transaction or activity that may relate thereto. Next slide. From a defensive point of view, we regard the authorized dealers and the authorized dealers with limited authority as the first line of defense. They are the first bodies that will be involved when money is moved cross-border through the banking system. And we spend a lot of time on making them aware, training their staff on all levels of the impact of illicit financial flows, the way to identify, report these flows. We've developed certain mechanisms to alert the banks and the authorized dealers with limited authority when suspicious activity is detected or a specific trend of transactions are prevalent. Our strategy has changed from early detection and disruption of the activities. We are not focusing specifically on large amounts. We are focusing on the actual activity, try and detect the activity as early as possible, and by blocking or preventing these transactions to continue, we then disrupt the activities of the parties concerned. Next slide. We have, from the outcome of our measures, we've noted an increase in the matters referred to us by the banks when they come across suspicious transactions or activities, which obviously enabled us to take earlier action and prevent a continued process of money leaving the country illegally. And that was the result of the awareness campaign. Our enhanced mining of our data has also enabled us to pick up certain trends, identify entities, which resulted in a number of additional cases being opened. We have noted from the previous feedback session that the strategy has enabled us to increase the number of cases, but we can see a reduction in the amounts involved. I think because we act earlier, the entities concerned or parties concerned do not have the benefit of continuing with the same transactions for an unlimited period. Obviously, you're not dealing with people that have the best of intentions, so they keep on changing their strategy, the modus operandi, and we are continuously monitoring these activities with the idea of building countermeasures to try and deter these activities. There are some statistics. Blocking orders issued 2016-2017, approximately 145 million rand. The previous period, 307 million. The contravention amounts, and this is just an estimation, 2016-2017, we're looking at roughly 3.2 billion. 2015-2016, we were looking at 14.6 billion. From our estimations and calculations, our actions in disrupting the activities may have resulted in the preventing of about 5 to 8 billion in these illegal flows. Money forfeited to the state in 2016-17, 228 million. Regulation 3 seizures, these are the funds that you read about in the paper where people are stopped on their way in out of the country with large amount of cash in their possession. About 41 million rands worth of cases were referred in the 2016-17 period, previously about 86 million. I would just note that not all these cases are necessarily referred to us. Some are dealt with by law enforcement or customs and other agencies. We have reported 31 fairly large cases to South African law enforcement for investigation. I think we've changed our strategy in the sense that instead of just going for blocking the money or seizing assets, we are now also falling through with laying a criminal charge against the parties, especially where false documentation and other activities have been detected. There was one successful prosecution, but not for the actual contravention of the regulations, but for bribery and corruption. A person was received a jail sentence of 11 years. The challenges, obviously capacity, I think parallel investigations where more than one agency are busy investigating the same case. I think we need to improve our communication in this regard.
Can we look at that when it comes to improving capacity?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of people are spilling over, it's fine, but it's better that we just so we organize a strategy for the committee.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So can you close up, please?
Yeah. That's
very unusual for a Reserve Bank official to speak at such length, I'm shocked. I thought you won't speak for even 3 minutes, but great. Let's go on to SAPS. Really, can we be blunt? SAPS, my brother, Colonel, you and the NTA are the most important people here, with due respect to the others, right? We want to know what's being done. Why are the people not in jail? When are they to go to jail? When can you report back to us that you're delivering maybe about 50 people a month in jail between you and the NPA? That's what we really want. So over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Chair. I need to start off by saying I have taken note of, let me rather put our position first. As the police, and I must say it categorically, just to be clear, I am with the Hawks, Director of Priority Crime Investigation. Now, SAPS, we are all policemen, but the Hawks operate with a different mandate. Now, as a rule, we will be reactive in terms of matters being referred to us. Now, we hear there are some departments who say that certain things are referred to law enforcement agencies. Now, I don't want to be naive just to assume it has been to the Hawks. It would be good to hear which law enforcement agencies these reports have been sent to, so that we're clear, because from where I sit, this commercial crime, just to explain the flow, as we receive the report, because now I hear there's suspicious transaction reports that are sent to the Reserve Bank, and as a rule, it would have been sent to us to investigate. Now, I think we just, maybe as government institutions, I think we need to have some sort of mechanisms where we purify certain functions of investigations, because we sit here and there's quite a number of government departments investigating these issues. And I think if we have to be clear, if we speak like Chair, Honourable Chair, ask us now, when are we going to put these people in jail? Then that would entail we must receive those reports, but it must receive it with substance in order for us to start criminal investigations so that we can compile a docket and forward it to the prosecutions for them to decide as to prosecution or not. At this point in time, Chair, I think maybe at the return meeting, I would be in a position to say we have so many cases on hand and so many cases are court-bound for us. We can't say how many would be guilty or not, but we can say how many cases we have received and from where and what is the current status of those cases. As we sit here now, I'm not in that position currently. Hopefully by the next return date, I should be in a position to say that to this committee.
With fairness, we started just to report to you, 3.5 weeks ago I spoke to Franco Buchmann, I explained the whole situation to him. He agreed. I had 5 to 6, no, if you put the SMSs together, 9 exchanges, with emails, probably around 15 exchanges, I can list it between your chairperson and myself, right? Then, Alan Wickham has been dealing with your parliamentary liaison officer. Up to 48 hours ago, you were saying you don't know what you're supposed to do, and we said, how? It's very clear. You could argue you wanted another language. That's unfair. There's 11 languages, so we can get a translator if necessary. But you can't say you don't know what. Now you're coming here and telling us you don't have the figures that we want to know. It's fair for a committee chairperson, but maybe I should stop here. Maybe the other chairs want to say something before we throw it open. Are we being unfair or what? Say, I don't know.
No, I think you're right on track, chairperson. I mean, I don't see any need to have a discussion about it. Presenters here are well aware of the facts, and members from the various entities and departments. And really, you're quite correct. I don't know if our minerals chair wants to comment.
I'm not sure, Chair, because when there is no report, there is no report. And I find it very strange. Again, I can't see how the law enforcement agencies work, but to come and say so and so should have done it, it actually says there is no integrated work. But I would hate to transfer an observation in another committee's performance, but I think it's an issue that even the committee must deal with. Because if then, let's assume it was reported, it actually means the Hawks will not communicate with the mainstream of police, and police then say we've never received from Hawks. I don't know which is which, because I would have assumed when the report is needed, the report would have been compiled on the cooperation of the same entity, because the Hawks themselves, they fall under police, so that they do a specialized job. So I find it very odd. In actual, if there was something that was done, it could have been easy to say, we don't know the stats, but we think there's so much work that has been done. It actually means it's not a priority matter of what is being being performed by at the level of the law enforcement agencies. But that is my deduction, except there's an explanation beyond that. But in simple terms, it means this is not a priority matter for now that is being performed by the law enforcement agencies.
I just clarify also for members, you need to know this about the process. According to Mr. Buchmann, Comrade Buchmann, last week there was going to be a representative from the Hawks here. So you're not representing the Hawks, I gather. You represent commercial crime. Is that right?
Okay, I am. Commercial crime is one component within the Hawks.
So you are within the Hawks.
So I'm representing the Hawks here.
Yeah, so that's what, so I mean, it's correct. And then yesterday you gave me your name, but I took it, you from the Hawks. So it is the correct unit, if you like, of the SAPS, right? But, or I will give you some time to, fairness to you, this is your first meeting. I don't think we should be, now we made our point, we are unhappy, but we can't let this thing last. The next meeting is in August of the three committees. No, we'll have to meet again very soon, even if it's for half an hour or whatever, to get a report. But can you, we can give you some breathing space, because there's a discussion now, and we can't ask you very much. The next session is 11:00, if you get somebody to email you figures and so on, of number, I mean, this ICT age, it can be done, my friend. Tell us the number of IFF issues you've been dealing with in the last year that you reported on. It'll be in your report. How you're tackling it. What sort of expertise do you need? What expertise you have to address this issue? And so on. In saying this, can I raise something in fairness? When we were in this international conference, that one day thing, we were really struck by people in advanced industrialized world also noting that this illicit financial flows, it moves so fast that every time governments introduce new laws, these tax experts, so to speak, they themselves, as Floyd once said, should be brought here, hauled here, and asked, why do you do these things, right? This blind blurring of lines between what is legal tax avoidance and what is illegal tax evasion. Hey, just pay the money where you produce the value, man. Those things are niceties we don't have the energy or time for in a country like ours. But you know what's interesting, even there, to be fair to you now? Even there in the advanced industrialized world, the British Parliament hosted this. What were they saying? They were saying that their own police force doesn't have the expertise to tackle these things. Their own prosecuting authorities don't. That doesn't excuse the Hawks at the moment. I'm just saying that. All right, fine, we'll come back to this. I don't know what we can do here. We can flagellate, but it's not going to help.
I was just saying to my colleague, Chairperson Karim, that we've heard from four other agencies who've indicated to us that they are referring these matters for criminal investigation. So you haven't received them. This is what I don't understand. Are they going to the wrong address? Do you understand? Because they're all referring them to yourself. Who should they be referring it to for criminal investigation? Perhaps other agencies aren't sending them to you.
We don't... what would be the point? Okay, Mr. Meenia, do you want to respond?
No, Chair, I was just going to say that...
Personally, can we be clear, my friend? It's not fair on you, right? Your parliamentary liaison officer could have
run. Chairperson, you must just indicate if he receives the referrals from these other agencies,
yes,
of areas that require criminal prosecution, so that we know,
yeah,
the extent of...
No, you're right. Yeah, I thought he said he's not, so
yeah,
we find out why. But anyway, Floyd is right. That's the germane issue, question here. Am I not? You're saying you don't know?
Where we ask questions.
Yeah, hang on. But let's finish this. There's only one more input, NPA. But I just want some clarity to give you some time maybe to get some of the information. Answer Mr. Shivambu's question, please. Ms. Fabs.
Chair, I was going to ask, just for time, if I could be excused to get the information, because I don't want to thumb suck in answering questions. And when I come back, I should be in a position to field questions and give proper answers to it.
Shall we say 11:45? action on Panama Papers. Yeah, well, let's say then that doesn't involve you. So you can even come back at 12 o'clock. How about that?
That's fine, sir. Thank
okay. And if you can email it to A. Wickham, A-W-I-C-O-M-B, at Parliament, A-W-I-C-O-M-B, and then we can distribute it to members. So you'll come back at 12, my friend. I apologize. I'm not apologizing. I understand you can't be held personally. Yes. Okay, good. Then can we move on, please, colleagues? Tandy had a hand up, and David. And then Sifiso. Well, everybody can speak then. Floyd's already spoken. My friend, Comrade Chair. Mantashe. Yeah. Okay, quick.
Yeah. Chair, I'm not going to do what you are doing. You see, we are watering down the problem that we have. I'm going to face the problem the way it is. It's unacceptable that we come to this meeting and we have people that we gave a responsibility not ready to report to us. It's unacceptable, and I'm not going to be like you. I'm saying it. Because when we last met here, we were expecting to get figures. And I'm saying thank you to SARS for the information you gave us. You gave us figures of the work you did. Wonderful job. You were able to get money on illicit flows. You've done your work. I'm not impressed by the department I used to lead. Every time they send different people who don't give us any information, the DTI, chair of the DTI, I hope you'll attend to this problem. We get generic information every time the DTI approaches this meeting. It doesn't bring what it's been doing in terms of shareholdership and ownership. I hope next time when the DTI approaches this meeting, it will give us that information. We're not going to be told about FATF. We know what FATF is. When it goes to SAPS, doesn't matter which unit of SAPS is here. It's one organization. It must report to us. It can't be that 31 cases has been forwarded to SAPS. Only one has been successfully prosecuted out of 30 cases. Is SAPS afraid to deal with corruption and illicit flows? It's not about an individual and which information they have. 30. Unless if we change and empower the FIC, because we've been avoiding to give the FIC a mandate that doesn't belong to them. SAPS is frustrating the FIC. The FIC is doing its work, and things are getting stalled there by SAPS. We should say it here. It's not an issue of an individual who don't have information. If he does not have any deals with commercial crimes, and he doesn't have this information now, it's not there. So I'm saying moving forward, the next meeting, at least, we'll have a similar report that SARS has given us. SARS gives us clear cut that people are doing illicit flows. All that needs to be done is for those who've got the investigation capacity to do their work. And thanks to see Comrade Willie, you see they did not want to, as a public protector, maybe you can stay with us, Comrade Willie of Mayor, on this matter. I'm talking to you, Comrade Willie. But they didn't want you as a public protector. Please stay with us on this matter, on BEPS at least. I think you can do a good job. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Let me say that if I was the South African equivalent of Tony Soprano, I would be delighted. I mean, what you see here is frankly amateur hour. I completely agree with you and my colleague that it is unacceptable. But let me make a proposal. The FIC referred, if I understand the annual report correctly, 511 matters for further investigation in the last financial year. Within a reasonable period, let's ask this group to prepare a report with the status of every single one of those 511 matters. In respect of Saab, 31 matters have been referred for further investigation. Let's get a report in writing on the status of every single one of those cases from the relevant authority. That is my proposal. There might be some constraints in how one reports the status of those investigations, but I'm sure it can be done. And I think my proposal would be that we get a formal report in writing within a reasonable period. Chair, I just want some guidance from you. This section is not over yet. I've got some specific...
Are we coming to that, yes?
Specific questions about specific investigations.
Yeah, well, we're trying to manage the SAPS productive engagement under the circumstances.
But
you can excuse the gentleman.
Do you want to put those questions?
No, about SAPS.
Yeah, these are specific...
Oh, yes, okay. Okay, maybe that's correct. What we're going to allow now so that... I'm sorry about the way it's panned out, but it'll be important to hear the NPA also. So why can't we just let the NPA speak? Because there's a relationship between the SAPS and the NPA's work. And then you hear the questions that we'll direct to the SAPS first, my brother, and then you can exit and come back at 12. How about that? Right. So can we quickly do the NPA? Thank you. Welcome, Willie Hofmeyr. We know you very well, and our sister there next to you. I won't start about how many thousands of years I know you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just waiting for the... So, Chair, in terms of the presentation we have, I'm not going to go through the purposes. It will be on the screen in a moment there, but I'm dealing with it under the following headings, which I'm not going to repeat here. I think firstly, just to make it clear that when we talk about illicit financial flows, law enforcement deals with those flows that are criminal offenses. Many of the other things that constitute illicit flows are not crimes. They may be against specific regulations and so on, but they've not all been criminalized. So I just want us to be clear of that. There is one part of the NPA Act that may give some gap. So in the asset forfeiture, the non-conviction-based asset forfeiture, there is provision to forfeit proceeds from what's called unlawful activities that may not be criminalized. That has been used to some degree, but not to a large degree up to date. I also just want to make clear, and I'm not going to go through the slide in detail, but we don't deal with the bulk of the BEPS issue for that reason. It is issues that sits with regulators and other bodies, and the contraventions are not criminalized by and large. But where there is criminal activity, I think we do make a plea for those cases to be referred to us with special attention between us and the AUC so that they can get the attention. So the NPA's focus is largely on identifying, freezing, forfeiting proceeds of crime and prosecuting those who have facilitated those flows. We work very closely with our other partners who are here. We have, or want to talk a little bit about some of the lessons that we've learned. We have identified several new patterns of illicit money flows and across different crime types, and as a result, a working group was set up to look at some of these cases, to work with other domestic and foreign law enforcement, as well as the private sector, and see what the lessons are that we can learn. One of the things that was found is a sort of new modus operandi, and essentially that involved a few different things. So the one was the abuse of exchange control regulations in relation to allowances and the prepayment of goods. So goods may be paid, but never delivered, for instance. Secondly, avoiding detection. We have found in looking at some of our very big cases that there are gaps in the current customer verification processes. For example, you can walk into a bank and literally deposit 10 million rand in cash. There is no customer identification requirement. The bank doesn't ask for that customer to say, who are you that's making this deposit? And it's usually into another person's bank account, of course. So I think those are some of the gaps in the legal framework that we do need to address. I think the biggest case that we have been looking at with our partners in the DPCI, SARS, FIC, Reserve Bank, is a syndicate that has managed to smuggle about just over 2 billion rand from South Africa in a very short period using different techniques. I think the other issue that we want to raise is that there has been a significant increase in the last period in the number of cash seizures that have been made, whether at airports or ports of entry. I'm not going to go through this. I think this adds up to close to 200 million rand in the last just under 2 years, which is sort of unprecedented in terms of our previous experience. I can't say that we're necessarily doing a better job. I think this really points to the fact that a lot more money is flowing. Some of the systemic weaknesses do exist. There are provision, for example, for incoming passengers to have a cash declaration form. Many of you who have traveled overseas have filled in those forms when you go to other currencies to say, I'm carrying 10,000 rand in cash when I'm arriving. And that can obviously then be used against the person if you search their luggage and find 1 million rand in cash. That is not implemented at the moment due to the administrative burden. The current exchange control regime is also too narrow, and I think some of the examples I give later will give you an indication of how it is evaded. Thirdly, the cash seizure system that we have in our POCA legislation at the moment is no longer in tune with international best practices. I think many countries have really simplified and expedited that process to be able to cope with the quantity of work that has to be done. I think there's also training issues. We've come across a few cases now where first law enforcement personnel at the airport regard the area between customs, immigration and the aircraft as a sort of no man's land where there is no law. People may be found there with a huge amount of money, but nothing can be done about it because the customs people won't go in there to do something or, you know, it's just not dealt with. It's not a correct perception, but that does seem to be a training issue. And then I think one of the big issues I've raised already, but is the know your customer, some sort of know your customer requirement for people who make very large cash deposits who can remain anonymous. I think the FIC has raised the issue, but the big issue is for family trusts, which is the major way of criminals and legitimate people making their ownership of assets invisible. And the reality is all in piles of paper in different offices all over the country. You cannot put in an ID number anywhere and say this person has 20, 30, 40 trusts in their name. You have to find physical evidence when you search the house of the trusts, and if they're clever enough, you will never find it. So I think that is a project that really needs to be pursued, I think, by the relevant committees in Parliament. I think the second important point there is, I'm being a little bit and deliberately vague here, but there are high-value negotiable instruments where there are no requirement for customer identification. There's large case that I talked about, the 2 billion rand, was really by buying different kinds of goods in supermarkets on a massive scale and exporting them. Now, somebody walks into a supermarket and buys 5 million rands worth of high-value goods in cash. Nobody knows who the person was. So I think that has been a trend for a much larger movement of cash through non-conventional means out of the country.
Sorry to interrupt you, but we want to welcome the three chairpersons of three different committees, the learners who are here, to see your parliament at work. I hope you'll stay a bit longer than your teachers might have planned welcome, because then the members behave when you are here. And as soon as you are gone, they don't listen to us at all. And as soon as you come back or others will come back, then they behave. So this is not the way the parliament normally works. This is simply because you
are able to exercise discipline over them that we can't, right? Also to tell you that we're looking at a matter where companies mainly, but others too, individuals, they make money in this country, but they don't pay the tax they're supposed to pay on it. So we have less as a government, as a state, to give towards education and so on. So we're trying to see what we can do about it. Welcome to your parliament, and hopefully many of you will be here in this parliament. You know you can now be president of this country and so on. So the world's opened up to you in many respects. So welcome. Over to you, Willie.
So, Chair, I think one of our suggestions there is that we need to look seriously at some sort of requirement for suspicious transaction reporting at major retailers where those sort of amounts of money in cash is being spent. I'm not going to talk too much about the Hawala banking issues. I think the committee is fairly familiar with that. But I think there is also a lack of coordination. I think things have improved with some of the practical working togethers, but between the private sector and the state, and I think that's still something that the committee should look at going forward. So in terms of steps forward, I've mentioned the issue of family trusts, some sort of electronic records that are searchable for information, and then the issues around a simplified procedure for the detection and seizure of large cash amounts. I think we also would like the committee to look at the Money Laundering Advisory Council because we do believe that it could play an important role. We believe it is in the process of being abolished or has been abolished, I'm not quite sure. We also think that it may be important to create a formal joint structure between the JCPS and finance with capacity to deal with the illicit money flows, because it really goes across the two clusters, as I indicated earlier. In terms of other steps forward, we think that it is important to work better with the FIC and the Border Management Agency to look at the clash declaration reporting, to engage with the private sector. I think the other inputs is dealt with that, to improve systems, controls, and reporting, with the Reserve Bank about exchange control. I think an important issue is law enforcement training about detecting and dealing with illegal cash when it is found, whether it's in a normal search or a roadblock or at the airport. And we think that we really should think about making some of the issues around this as a formal target in the JCPS cluster targets. I think one's experience is that when things are not targets, they tend not to get done. And we do believe that there is important issues around this. So, Chair, I think those are the major issues that we wanted to raise with the committee.
All right. Can we have questions now? Firstly, those directed at the SAPS so they can be excused, right? So it's David Mania, Sipis who had his hand up, Brandon, my brother Yabongani, Floyd, Masachope Sitole. Pule, please. I didn't leave you out for the reason. Amusingly, that you told me so. Just worried that you might be discriminated against. You want to speak? You have full rights like anybody else. You sure? Okay. Right.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, am I clear that we're just asking questions?
Yeah, we're asking SEPs, then the others will come in. Yeah. Okay, good. Can we go in the order that I saw your hands go up? Right. Okay. You know your numbering, right? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, once again, now that we're done with the presentations, this is yet another parliamentary hearing, which is long on strategy, long on process, long on analysis, and zero outcomes. That's why, once again, I want to emphasize that what we need is a statistical analysis of every single matter referred.
Is anything new? Yeah, you made the point.
Okay. In the last financial
year. Fine, agreed.
On specific matters. I referred a matter to the Hawks requesting an investigation into the 72 suspicious transactions totaling 6.3 billion rand contained in the Minister of Finance's affidavit, which was signed on the 13th of October 2016. My question to the Hawks is that matter being investigated? What is the current status of that investigation? Then I have two specific questions to the Reserve Bank. In that same affidavit, there is a letter dated the 12th of August 2016, signed by Kuben Naidu, the Registrar of Banks, where he makes reference to a transaction involving VR Laser Asia, a company associated with Oak Bay, which could form the basis of an exchange control-related investigation. My question to Saab is this matter under investigation? What is the current status of this investigation? Then my third question, also to Saab. On the 15th of April 2016, I asked the South African Reserve Bank to investigate whether the banks had complied with their investigations under FIC and various National Treasury guidance notes in respect of the Gupta accounts and the Oak Bay accounts. Is that investigation underway? What is the current status of those investigations?
I have something. We forgot minerals. Is that right? You didn't make an input, eh? Is that right? Where's minerals? Sorry, you didn't make your input. Is that right? I apologize. Minerals didn't make the input. Oh. Okay, the chairperson said, sorry. But can we let it flow now that it's happened? And then minerals, you'll be called in, right, to make your first input. Sorry about that. I apologize. I'm getting old and doddery. Sifiso?
Chair. I've got Chair. I'm can I have clarification? Is that we are talking about issues related to the police, other issues?
So they can leave, yeah.
Okay, no, I'll make it pass then, because I've got other issues, not police related issues.
Who's next? Brandon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specific for the police, but I think the other members must also listen to correct me if I'm wrong, and it's also for clarification. My understanding is the police receive information, and I use the term police widely here, the South African police services, including the Hawks, directly from FIC. I'm asking, do they get it from one office of FIC, or does FIC have more than one unit that decides the case and sends it to you? Do they send it at this point to multiple police stations particularly, or does FIC in this case send it just to one office of the police service? Then the FIC would send at the same time that information, I believe, to SARS, if they believe it's SARS related. They could also send it to Saab and or any of the other law society, etc. But let's just focus on SARS and Saab, who would then do independent investigations and who could also then, for other non-FIC-related transgressions, report a criminal offence to the police as well. So Saab could, in Pretoria, go to the central police station, or they could go to who? Because this is part of our problem in for you to report to us. And same with SARS. Does SARS, at each of his offices across the country, make an independent assessment and then go to their local unit of the police? Or does it get central through Pretoria, through one office, to one office in the police? And if not, isn't that the type of unit we should be trying to set up, a specialized unit to handle all crimes related to FIC and or Saab, let's call them illicit flow transactions? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who's next, please? Bongani.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. My also is directed to SABS, because I don't like to be hearing rumors, you know, and gossip. Is there any complaint that came to you in relation to the so-called Dubai cash transit from South Africa? And do you have names of those people who are taking money from South Africa with big bags with flights to Dubai? You know, because if these things are rumors, they are dangerous for our country. Is there any person that have filed any complaint with the South African Police Service? The second one is the question of, is related to the exchange controls regulations. I'm not saying that you must talk about things that are in court today. But what made that SAPS is unable to monitor the airports and the cash in transit at airports, given the cash that was robbed now, allegedly by police and other people. So what is the real involvement of SAPS in those related questions? Thank you very much.
Please. Floyd.
No, thanks, Chairperson. On the 4th of October 2016, we opened a police case at the Rosebank police station against the Guptas and Duduzane Zuma and all those people that were mentioned in the affidavit of the Minister of Finance. And the FIC mentioned, we even wrote the FIC about that. And then we're contacted by General Prince Mukotidi. And then he said, no, we have noted your report and we'll come back to you. He has not come back to us. He said it's from Commercial Crimes Unit. And they're going to give us an update on the money movements which were highlighted by the Minister of Finance in that affidavit. So we want to, of course, if they are able to talk to that, they can talk to it and everything else. But I'm interested in understanding what is the relationship between the FIC and the SAPS in terms of enforcement of laws that relate to financial crimes. What do you do? Like, what is the relationship in that regard? And perhaps, Chair, later on we'll discuss that. Perhaps we need different mechanisms to enforce laws around financial crimes than SAPS. It looks like most of these issues are above their heads, technically, and they can look into other issues, and then maybe there must be a different unit that enforces laws that relate to financial crimes, because there are a lot of them. And it looks like nothing is being done about it. Perhaps there is a discussion that we must have separate from their responses. The person who came to represent SAPS is either him or the institution that he represents have no clue of what we're busy with and the issues that have to be attended to. I think we must be honest enough as Parliament to say that they are not the correct instrument and vehicle to enforce laws that relate to financial crimes. And perhaps consider a different mechanism to deal with financial crimes. You correctly have noted that even other countries have got the same difficulty of utilizing the conventional law enforcement agencies to deal with otherwise extremely sophisticated criminal activities that is done by syndicates and quick money movements. In terms of what gets to happen, perhaps we must design a different mechanism of how we respond to it, and who can be a leader globally in terms of how that is dealt with. Thank you, Chair.
Ma Shofi Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't want to ask a question, but I just want to express an observation that we are dealing with something that, you know, we take seriously, all of us, but it doesn't seem to be taken seriously by some of the government departments. For instance, DTI, I expected to see some document or something like that. You know, to expect us as members of parliament, we are not economists and we are not accountants, you need to take us on board so that we can be able to apply our minds. But, you know, if you just come and speak as if, you know, somebody just grabbed you in the street and you didn't know about this meeting, it's very discouraging. And the police,
I thought the police are up to scratch with the use of technology. It doesn't seem to so to me, because I don't think it would be a problem seated where this gentleman is just to send an SMS to his office to say, email this and this document. But it seems he need to go and carry some files. At my age, I don't do that. I use technology. I could have called my secretary to bring to email something to me. I don't believe that it's a question that they don't use technology. But the impression I have is that they don't take this matter that is worrying us very seriously. And I'm also aware that there is Chapter 3 of the Constitution that demands that departments should work together. Actually, there is a section in Chapter 3 that says all spheres of government shall conduct their business in a manner that does not divide the Republic of South Africa. But in the case of the police, it doesn't even divide the Republic of South Africa. It divides the police itself. I am really discouraged.
You're covered, David. Short, very short.
Chair, it's obvious that the member representing the Hawks is in a predicament, but when he comes back, I wonder if he could just, so we can properly understand, what brief did he get, from whom did he get the brief, and when did he get the brief?
Yeah, I'm not sure you need to answer that, because I can give you the... Aaron, can you give Mr. Mania all the electronic evidence, right? Started with the first letter to Mr. Buettmann to his private address. Give it to him. We're not going to answer that. The question isn't...
It's not directed to you. It's directed to the member.
Yes. But can I raise something, Tandy? I actually agree with everything the committee... Well, almost everything the committee members have said. There's no difference, Tandy, between you and me. But you know how government works. And this gentleman, is a general... Kani, what is it? Kani. How do you spell that? It's K? General Kani. See, what I'm trying to say, it's not fair to focus on him only. It's the institution that's at issue, right? He may have, I know what David's trying to hint at. Maybe he got found, I thought it's wonderful, Master Tole. Your point, you weren't dragged from the street. It's very evocative. The point is, he might have been found this morning. How is it going to help you, David, to know that? That's an internal matter. I don't think you have to answer that. Parliament did its job. DTI, the chairperson, supposed to have notified DTI 3.5 weeks ago. The letter was drafted and sent, right? So that's the matter. So can we just do this? On the matter of SAPS, before we ask the gentleman to go, is there anything else? No. Right. Now, I think the co-chair wants to say
that
something.
She's going to get, he's going to get the documents, isn't he?
Yeah.
So we're fine with that.
Yeah.
And it was not on...
Fongani, it's about this matter of SAPS, yes? Okay.
I was just wondering, because if the SAPS will say it doesn't have information, I'm not sure what is the relevance of the crime statistics reports in South Africa. Because we were just listening a week ago about the crime statistics report, and I didn't hear anything about what is being discussed here today and the referrals that came from other entities to the SAPS and the work done.
To respond, I think co-chair Luzipo wants to say something.
No, Chair, is it difficult when someone says, I don't have any information? You can do your best. The fact of the matter, that person doesn't have information. He's only going to cook the answers for you, and by the time you come back, you are discussing the provided wrong information. Now, I had one issue. I all the questions asked, I don't think it's a, maybe they will have to answer those questions if they can answer them, the direct questions that were asked. But I wanted to suggest a simple thing that, because quite clearly this is the actual point that we need to have the information so that we can measure the extent of work that is being done in terms of the enforcement of the law. Now, if there is no answer, it actually means you are just trying to get this information. But it's a policy matter whether you want to, I think it's a Mr. Hofmeyr who gave policy gaps on what is it that needs to be done
in order to close those gaps. Now, with the SAPS, you can't even get that sense now whether are there any policy gaps in terms of the legislative framework that you would need to make sure that to enforce them, let alone the statistics. So I wanted to suggest that maybe, depending how gullible we are, that together with the, we speak to the first, to the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Police, so that with all the trends that you have in the police service, to agree, I think the Honorable Karim made this proposal in 2 weeks' time. Now, I'm not sure whether we allow that to disappear because it was more like a statement in passing. So if we resolve in 2 weeks' time, we then say we will, because even that information that is sent, it's an email, it doesn't talk. And then say specifically with SAPS, can they come and brief the committee specifically on the work that is being done to deal and cap the issue of illicit financial flows? And then we can add, then we can factor in the questions that they can answer now and say amongst the briefing they will give is the issue of illicit financial flows. So that we can get a sense, the point that I think the Honorable Mkongi is raising, we can get a sense whether this is really part of their priority combat that they are undertaking. Otherwise, without doubt, that whether they get the information, there is enough evidence that is presented on the information that is given, we can only make that judgment on the basis of what they do. So if we can just be able to get that guarantee that they can be here in 2 weeks' time, we just specifically come for them and then deal with the issue. Maybe then from our respective committees, we can then be able to recommend what it is that is being done. So in one way, it's not about judgment. We're not being judgmental to them, but we want to get the facts so that we can be able to say, if the weakness of the law is on the other field of the sectors, we can then fix that law so that we can make their work more easier. But also if there is a problem with them also, so I wouldn't say let's rule out even the IPID, even if it also they have to bring it, so that if there is a problem of collaboration within them, how much work is the IPID is doing to deal with those issues. So all the trends of the law enforcement agent with regards to SAPS, then they be present. Then don't give us, though, why I'm worried is when you'll get the one say, no, we are the hawks, we are this thing. We want to see that unit as a whole, what is it that is doing in cooperation.
So what's the way forward? Sorry. All right, so we're not going to call you back.
No, we say, Chair, in the proposal you made or the statement you made in passing, in 2 weeks' time, SAPS in its totality must be here. They must give us a comprehensive report on their strategy to fight the issue of illicit financial flow. And then on the basis of that, we will also speak to the chairperson of the board. All of us will come here specifically to listen to that presentation that they'll be giving.
Yes, I understand that. Just to alert you, the Finance Committee hasn't got a single free day, just to let you know. So it'll have to be a late afternoon meeting around after 3 p.m. There's no slot, literally, comrade. So what happens now, is there no way you can reply to at least some of the questions that are more like straightforward? You can get it at 12 o'clock and then do a comprehensive response later. I'm just asking, is that possible? Or what are members suggesting? I'm being lost. Okay, let's hear Tandi, Bongani, Mr. Mania.
Chair, David presented specific issues that need immediate responses. And the issue that the Chair of Minerals has spoken to, when we come to recommendations, because I'm not having questions today, I've got recommendations based on what Comrade Willie has presented, things that must go to the JPCS. So I'll come at that point where you give us. So based on specifics, there should be some form of answers. If those answers are not here, that information can be sought, because those matters need to be responded to.
So is that agreeable that you do a temporary response? I think what the co-chair is suggesting is correct. One can't expect a full comprehensive reply here. Moreover, you need to confer with your colleagues and so on. All of that is not feasible by 12 o'clock. It was never meant to be. I thought it was a two-phase process. But on the other hand, to be fair to the three chairs, exactly what the co-chair asked is what, well, I did on behalf of the three of us, right? I did exactly what he said. You know, I asked the chairperson, Chris, I'm not going to bore you with all that, right? I did all of that. But nevertheless, now we are where we are. I think what Comrade Luzipo is saying is correct, right? Let's go that route. So we'll give you some space, but we're not going to like interrogate you fully in the circumstances. But what we could do to assist the process is to itemize some questions that we can let him have, let's say, what's today, Wednesday, by, say, Monday, 12 o'clock, put all the questions in as well. So there's, you know, direct. We can't have a full-blown meeting, Comrade said. It's not going to be possible. There isn't a single thing we can forego in finance. So it'll be a short, say, an hour and a half meeting one afternoon after 3 p.m. So it'll be about 3 p.m. to 5, maybe 2 hours on one of the days. We can negotiate. Remember we now that you, what I understand you to be saying, Comrade, is you want the SAPS committee also to be here. So we'll have to negotiate and see. It also means starting from square one in some senses, because the average member in SAPS committee sort of is not in the loop. But having said all of that, it'll be an afternoon meeting before the, by the last day of the sitting of Parliament, or maybe that Friday morning when Parliament rises. That's another prospect. I won't be here, but you can go ahead, right? Can we just move on then? We can exit, relieve you, and then you'll come back at about 12:15 or so. Well, it's already, say about 1 o'clock. How about that?
I just needed clarity.
Yeah.
I've already started speaking with FIC, and I will engage SAP. And I think for the interest of to do a comprehensive and proper report to Parliament, not a half-baked thing, is on the issue of what we are doing currently on illicit financial flows. Can we come back and do a proper report on that? And then the questions that came now from the honourable members, I will go out and get answers to that and come back
to report.
That's
what Tandy is saying.
Chair, I agree with the thrust. The specific questions would be answered now, and in 2 weeks' time we would get a comprehensive report. But I want to come back to this question of a comprehensive statistical analysis of every single case. Now, no, I'm not covered, Chair. Just give me, because it's not going to be long before institutions start to say that they don't have authority in law to disclose information. There's no reason why, because ultimately we want a statistical analysis why each matter can't be assigned a random serial number. There's no reason.
Good. By government, are you?
No. I'm
right, so you represent Parliament, right? Good. He will decide on behalf of Parliament, and then people can go to court if they disagree with him. Simple. Right. Can we move on? Right. Now, then to Tandy in the first instance. And then, what's his name? My brother from Nambiti, Ladysmith. Right, can we go ahead, please? Yes, then it's let's have people, Brendan first, and then, my friend, you wanted to speak, right? You are Anton. Yes, Anton, Sifiso, and Floyd. Ah, yes, and Comrade Mantashe. Right, good. Alf, yes?
The man from the SAPS, does he understand he can leave if he wishes?
Yeah, sorry. Oh, he's still, he's still here. I thought, no, fine. Okay, good. No. That was a lie, my friend. Okay. No. I didn't notice he's still. The co-chair says the police needs to know you're not detained or a hostage. Right. Can we move on? Right. Who's, Tony, it's you, please.
I just want to make recommendations. I'm not going to ask questions. Actually, I'm pleased with the report that Comrade Willie has given us, because it says, but there's an issue that he said that actually highlights that the banks were not telling us the truth. I don't want to use the L word today, because the banks said that they have a system that looks at suspicious transactions. And now, Comrade Willy says, no, they don't. Because he makes an example that anybody can make a deposit of any amount without you tracing that. And I want us to come to the bottom of that, because in relation to what the banks have said they've closed up that gap. We asked them that question specifically when they were here, and they said they've closed it. So I want to recommend that we come back to that issue so that they can report those. Yes. Secondly, he said that there are matters that must be elevated to the JPCS cluster. So I'm making a recommendation that in our report, we look at those targeted issues that needs to be taken to the JPCS cluster. We engage our counterparts, the committee that deals with that. I know in the NGO, we will call the cluster itself, the security cluster, and then present this issue so that it can be taken as part of the key targeted issues that the JPS cluster in government must deal with. Because if those matters are not a priority, if the issues of BEPS are not a priority, then it means the work that we're doing here is effectively useless, because then they must implement, and we need to track the implementation. That's why I'm making that recommendation. Two, the issue of the three, that's the last, Chair. I won't be naughty today. The last point, the Money Laundering Council. The Money Laundering Council. I'm not sure, is it located in the FSC? If that's the case, maybe we should recommend that it should start to operate, and then we get a report, maybe in August, so that it's given clear mandates that came from the discussions that we had today. But I'm not sure the issue of the exchange control, whether it will lie with SARS or any other institution, so that we can look at how the systems have been manipulated. I'm just even trying to figure out that how particular currencies are being dealt with. I know for a fact that at one point SARS intercepted money in denominated in dollars that was taken out of South Africa. I think you'll remember, France, and that was a very interesting case, because if the exchange controls are not monitored properly, that issue will happen again. So we will have to relook at where are the gaps in relation to that. Chair, I'll stop there for today.
Who's next? Alf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the concern I have is that through your good office and others, we've brought a whole lot of different agencies together today. And all of them seem to me to be saying the same thing about the lack of communication. And so, if nothing else, I hope that this meeting achieves some...
Yeah, that comes under the later item, interdepartmental and intergovernmental cooperation. But still, it's fine.
Thank you for giving me the leniency there, Mr. Chairman. So that point, I think, is important. But then, Mr. Chairman, I thought that National Treasury, Momo, made some really good points about how we deal with information. You know, it's one thing to do what I've just suggested, is communicate about what charges and so on are on the go. But I wonder whether the various bodies here today would kind of give us some indication whether they do, in fact, look at newspapers, react to reports in newspapers, or do they just wait for someone to lay a charge or a referral from the FIC or whatever? I hadn't thought about that before. And Momo is it's an important point, because we as politicians tend to do that, and then try and get action out of the various agencies. But perhaps some indication on that. Then, France, no, you didn't do the report, sorry, the customs report. You know, on the one hand, Saab are reporting that they look carefully at these prepayments or advanced payments or whatever they are. And yet, on the customs side, you've it's something new, as I understand it, that you've now looking into this, and there doesn't appear to have been any reconciliation. Now, who should have been doing the reconciliation? So I'd say they're kind of doing the reconciliation. I'm just a bookkeeper, but I know that if I do a payment from the bank account, it's going to credit the bank account, and the debit's going to go somewhere, and the debit will sit there until I find something to match it to. I just don't understand how Saab seems to be saying they're doing it. The customer's saying, well, this is something new we're now looking at. And the point is not that it's all nicely reconciled, finding that it's not reconciled, that huge numbers of transactions just sit in the void. They never get reconciled until you ask the question. Then in terms of the kind of cash issues, is there any attempt, and I don't know whose hand this, again, you see this is the kind of confusion that reigns with me. And when this amount of cash is transferred, or how do we establish whether it's hot cash? You know, it's one thing to be looking at illicit transfers, but, you know, perhaps it's stolen money or whatever. You know, does the tracing go right back to the origin of the cash? Maybe it's a silly return. It's a question. I'm not an expert. Then could you explain to me about, I didn't really catch what you were talking about when you talked about tax returns, income tax returns, the IT-14 and so on. I just need a bit more clarity of what you were referring to. I think it's on your slide 10. Perhaps I'm just not understanding them. Then, Murray, the stats are quite horrific in a sense. You talk about your capacity to deal with the workload. So 9.5 million reports resulted in 2,500 odd actions. Is that because you were able to get through all 9.5 million and you only found 2.5, or because you just didn't have the capacity and 2.5 was all you could deal with? Because the difference is huge. Desmond, in terms of DTI, I mean, beneficial ownership is one of the key things, I think, with regard to the Twin Peaks Act, or about to be Act. And so you're saying that's now going to be a declaration, annual declaration, in terms of the Companies Act and declaring to the CIPC. So if the beneficial ownership changes during the year, what is the declaration going to be? Is it going to be a point in time, or is it going to be every change throughout the last 12 months? How do you plan to deal with that? Because, we can... Shareholdings change rapidly, and particularly if it's traded on a stock exchange. It's not a point in time that's critical, or a single point in time per annum, which is what the annual return normally is. But, annual return can be incorporate all sorts of things without making it too onerous. Now we don't have closed corporations anymore, so everyone uses a company. And so I hope that when one includes this kind of thing in the annual return, it doesn't put a huge administrative burden on one-man shows, for want of a better word. Murray, I think you were the only one, and I stand to be corrected, who kind of referred to a task team of multi-agency task team. And maybe someone else did. Forgive me if my 64-year-old memory isn't that good. But is it working? And how can we help to make it a really good interaction? And then, Willie, in terms you, only one thing. I mean, there's lots of good stuff in your report, but I noticed that you refer to family trusts and not to trusts. I'm not sure why there's an emphasis on family. I personally don't have a trust, but I used to deal with lots and lots of trusts for my clients, and they were all family trusts, but they were all operating legally, I hope, as far as I know they were. So is it specifically family trusts or just trusts you're focusing on?
Thank you, Chair. One of the reasons cited for the global financial crisis is the prevalence of financial engineers. Those are sophisticated people who deal with the finances. That's what resulted, amongst other reasons, on the global financial crisis. Why I'm citing that is that most of these illicit financial flows, these are the people who are concerned, who engineer these things. So they are very complicated structures. Let's accept that. Very, very complicated structures. That becomes important as to how do we respond. I think there are so many structures, departments who are involved with this illicit financial flow combating. But what is very clear from the presentations that we have had, that they are working in silos. And if we continue doing that, we'll never be able to catch people who are doing these things. So a proposal, Chair, that one would make is that can these different arms of government take this thing as a very, very serious problem, and then they come together and then have a collective strategy as to how they are going to deal with this thing. I think it's a suggestion that one would make. If we continue working in these silos, that will never be able to catch these people. That's one. Two, perhaps the observation that we can continue hatching the legislations that we were busy with, including the Twin Peak and so on. But if they are not properly implemented and we don't have people who properly implement them, we'll come again and make another legislation and another legislation and another legislation. To Chair, the question of, I think one can't help but see that this, for whatever reason, these financial crimes as a country, don't treat them seriously. And in one of the gatherings that I was in, I said, can we please call them what they are? You see, because we call them collusion, we call them illicit financial flows. In most cases, we find this is fraud. It's fraud and theft. And can you please call those things fraud and theft so that we can respond properly to fraud and theft, which runs into billions of rands. Then coming to the questions that I would like to pose. First, you talk about 34 billion rands of ghost imports. Over what period? I think that becomes important. Over what period? So that we can look at the extent of this thing. I think to FIC, it is curious for me to note that of the Panama Papers, our jurisdictions haven't found anybody who has acted illegally. Other jurisdictions are busy prosecuting people, as it were. I don't know whether it's a function of our capacity to deal with this thing. But for me, I think we need to dig deeper. There is an issue there. To the Reserve Bank, you speak about block orders about 5 to 8 billion rand. For me, that's attempted crime. Somebody was attempting to commit crime. What do we do with those people? Do we just end up by, blocking them, and that's the end of the story? Attempted murder is a crime, and I think attempting to do this type of crime, again, should be a crime and should be a serious crime, because if we didn't find them, that man would have gone out of the country. But I think we shouldn't just be looking at money flowing out of the country and so on. We should be looking at the impact that thing is doing to the economy. I may argue, Chair, that perhaps this financial year, if we didn't have these illicit financial flows, wouldn't be having the deficit that we're having. And then the multiply effect to the things that we'd have done and so
think.
On.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
It's an overwhelming fact,
what
you are saying.
Yeah. So, Chair, I'm saying that we shouldn't just be looking at rand and cents flowing. We should be looking at the impact that that would have to the economy and to the lives of our people, especially the poorest of the poor. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Who's next? Anton, and then who's then the big speakers come as Brandon, and then Floyd, and then David.
Anton, it's Comrade Mantashe, Floyd, Brandon, Floyd, and David.
Thank you, Chairperson. Many of the previous speakers have posed questions that I wanted to ask, but I would just like to add to it. I'm quite concerned about the fact that documents that liquid documents or securities documents can be used to get money out of the country, high value money out of the country, without doing a know your client process or a FICA process or anything in that regard. So we definitely have to look at that. What I would like to know specifically is the people who perpetrate these crimes that you have already seen, the trends that you've picked up. Is it organized crime trying to get their money out? Firstly, are there companies, like large companies in South Africa, trying to expatriate funds out of South Africa into tax havens or elsewhere? And are any politically connected or sensitive people involved in these transactions? We need to know the nature of these transactions, the broad trends, who are involved, to obviously be able to respond appropriately to the situation. Thank you very much.
Next, Comrade Montas.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think the non-integration of the work that departments do is not doing South Africa any favor. I agree with that notion. I'm looking at, people would look at the bigger companies that take mine out of the country, but there's these companies that are established by expatriates, I'm not xenophobic, who are in South Africa illegally, they have businesses all over. How do we collect tax from those people? Because most of them don't have bank accounts. How do they take mine out of our country? Which would at least minimize the impact of us having SARS to hike our taxes that we pay to him. But, Chairperson, I want to direct a question to the entity of trade and industry. He said, which I agree with, online gambling is illegal. How are they enforcing that people do not go that route? He has not told us. And again, in their agreements, in their trade agreements, negotiations, how do they deal? What are those arguments that they have with the countries they have negotiated with in as far as this illicit financial outflows? What are your arguments? What can you put in front of us to tell us in this and this and this country, this is what we have agreed upon, this is how we treat, we're trying to keep these financial outflows. Thank you, Chairperson.
Brandon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the report inside, we're looking at it maybe from the wrong point. FIC is a massive lead generator, and after FIC come these other agencies, as I mentioned earlier, then SAPS and then the National Prosecuting Authority. So we shouldn't be asking the question of FIC, how many of them lead to people going to jail. We should actually ask how many they referred to which agency and how many were duplicated, etc. And then we should ask each of the others, SARS, SARB, etc. How many leads did you get from FIC and what happened to those leads, etc. and so on. Please, how many leads did you get from SARS and how many did you get from SAPS, from wherever, etc. And then finally we ask MPA, how many did you get from the police and how many did you prosecute? I think that's where we should be looking towards in the long term. I want to reinforce what Advocate Hofmeyer said about trust. I personally must have been over 200-300 trusts. I have no idea how many trusts my name will appear on, etc. So, and you were no idea finding this out. And we need to find a way to get the various master's offices into the 21st century, and that falls under justice. So it might need to move. I don't know. But the point is, CIPC has spent millions on a very good system, and perhaps we've got to find a way for the two departments to speak and find a way to bring trust onto the CIPC type of system. And linked to that, you know, CIPC does not keep track of your shareholding. Your RCC is still in the operation. There we know the shareholding is. But in the UK, on your annual return, for instance, you have to declare who the last shareholders were every year and any changes. We don't have a similar requirement in South Africa. And for that matter, I can tell you as a company secretary of a listed company, I've got no idea who the shareholders are, many of the companies, because we have nominee shareholders. So a dematerialization of share certificates, most listed companies can't tell you who actually owns their shares. It just says PSG nominees or First National Bank nominees, etc. So the whole idea of trying to find beneficial shareholders is we're far away from that still in South Africa. So we need to look at that. If it's, and it's from my past experience, I'm sure it still is, it is a problem. We need to know who owns shares, etc. Then on the subject illicit. So for instance, we do want to attract foreign investment into South Africa. So counter to what was said yesterday, or implied yesterday, we do want foreigners buying shares in banks. We do want foreigners investing in companies in South Africa. So for instance, we do want Starbucks to come and put up franchises here, etc. And consequently, we're going to have to pay royalty payments outside of the country. So how do we find a mechanism to make sure that that is not considered illicit? The quantum, the transfer pricing question comes in. So at the moment, it's easy for a cyber company. You get a ruling from the Reserve Bank. We want to invest outside the country, and they give you a whole thing. But if you're a foreign company, you want to come set up a branch in South Africa. I'm not aware that you have to go to SARS and agree the terms of that franchise agreement with anybody up front. So perhaps we need to look at a division that does that. And then there's clarity. So everybody understands you're coming into South Africa, Tesco, and this is what we will be taking out of South Africa going forward. Is there anything like that at the moment? Because we do need foreign investment. And we can't chase them away because they're going to think, well, whatever we come up with will be considered illicit, so we're just not going to do business here, etc. And my last concern, which affects this committee, is this whole role of border management agency now in customs. We haven't considered in this committee, but I believe that it's been moved, or the intention of is to move that part of customs collection from SARS. And I don't know for certain if that is the case, but it does have an impact. And do we as a finance committee specifically want that to happen? Because SARS haven't told us about it, and it's got sort of between them and Home Affairs, I think. No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then it's somebody else who's last, David.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think that some of the issues that were contained in the 2017 budget represents a step forward in terms of how we can collectively deal with the illicit financial flows. I specifically refer to two statements which the Minister of Finance said. He said multinational companies will be required to file further information with SARS on cross-border activities from the end of the year, meaning from the end of 2017. And I think that arises out of the country-by-country reporting note that was issued by SARS in April 2016. So it helps with regards to the multinational companies because you can be able to trace the money movement and whether they are avoiding taxes here in South Africa. But the second thing which I think is even more interesting is that the minister says that SARS must continue to develop the skills and capacity needed to enforce legislation and strengthen its efforts to curb tax avoidance and evasion and address transfer pricing, a component of illicit financial flows. That is in the budget speech for 2017 that at least there is now a commitment that says we can deal with tax avoidance as well. But there is always this conceptual issue that certain levels and components of tax avoidance are permissible. That is where we need a legislative intervention to clearly define which one is acceptable, tax avoidance, which one is not acceptable. I think that we should either amend the Tax Administration Act or introduce a new legislation together to comprehensively deal with instances of tax avoidance. Because the tax avoidance happens through transfer pricing and therefore erodes the tax basis. The tax base of South Africa, like that you can collect taxes for developmental purposes. So it's one of the things that we have to agree that in principle we should clarify legislation on tax avoidance and
deal with what the SIU, the NPA is saying, that criminalize certain components of tax avoidance. You must criminalize that. Not actually all, you must criminalize tax avoidance in terms of what is being, so that NPA, SAPS know when to enter when a tax avoidance has been engaged in a very dangerous way. But as things stand, there are certain things that can be dealt with of illicit flows. And SARS and the SAPS are the weakest link. SARS, for political purposes, they refuse to pursue most of the issues that are brought to their attention. They do nothing about it, even when the banks have prima facie evidence on closing bank accounts of the Gupta family. It's beyond doubt that there's criminality involved there, and there's issues of the revenue collector which have to be attended to. But SARS folds its arms, doesn't do anything about it, because it has got political consideration in many things that it is expected to do. And it's a very dangerous thing to have a revenue collector that chooses who to pursue and who not to pursue and everything else. And it's one of the things that must be looked into. There are so many cases of pure aggressive tax planning, like and wrong practices, billions of rands that are taken, which is brought to the attention of SARS. They don't do anything about it. I mean, the Fallon Commission, for instance, the AIDC representative is here, illustrated how billions of rands were moved by lawmen out of South Africa to Bermuda. Nothing happened to them. And no action has happened to them. Instead, the PIC invested in lawmen for a certain stake there to save the company from collapsing when there was a crisis around platinum. So it's one of the things. And then the last issue which I want to speak to, perhaps the second last, is I think our legislation, Chair, should look into the aggressive tax planning practices of South African companies as well. I'll give you an example of the retail sector. So like in percentage terms to turnover, like Woolworth makes 11% profit as vis-a-vis to their turnover. ShopRite makes 5% at a group level. And Pick n Pay makes 2%. What do? Almost all businesses, they bloat their expenses and they declare far smaller profits so that they pay small taxes. And that cuts across all companies. I argue that South Africa can collect at 2 trillion rands from South Africa's business activities. It's reasonable vis-a-vis the GDP size that you can collect close to 40 to 50% of your revenue from that basis. But because of aggressive tax planning, most of these companies, even the domestic ones, they avoid taxes. I think that we must deal with that issue far much more clearly too, so that we are able to collect maximum taxes. And that is very important, because if you are unable to collect taxes maximally, you are then stuck with the permanent short blanket budget, which when you cover your head, you can't cover your feet. When you cover your feet, you can't cover your head forever. When you build houses for everyone, you can't pay for education. If you pay for education, you can't pay for houses. If you pay for both, you can't pay for roads and infrastructure. At the same time, whilst there is potential to could collect maximum revenue from the South African business sector, it's just that we need to put our laws much more properly. I mean, I'm interested in the FIC's response to the HSBC's bank links, because you said in Panama there were no South Africans involved. What did you do with regards to the 2015 Swiss banks, HSBC incidents, where there were South Africans there? There is money of South Africans in HSBC accounts in Switzerland. Is it legitimately there?
and what are we doing about it, Sean?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. My first question to Saab, you mentioned on slide 10 that you've changed your strategy, that your strategy now is to, in respect of law enforcement matters, to lay a charge yourself. I wonder if you could explain why you changed your strategy. My hypothesis is that you've changed your strategy, you lay a charge so that you have a case number and so that you can actually track progress in the case. And that sounds like a vote of no confidence in the SAPs to me, which, from what we've seen today, is entirely justified. The second question to the FIC on growth in reporting. There seems to be a number missing, Murray. You refer correctly, if you look, I'm now comparing your report with the 2015-16 annual report. And the number that's missing, which interests me, is it appears that there are correctly about 34,000 accountable and reporting institutions, which result in about 9.5 million reports, which in that year translated into about 511 matters referred to law enforcement. But the number that's missing is that of the 34,000 accountable and reporting institutions, only 3,500 actually reported. I wonder if you could explain why that number is so low. Is it correct to infer from that that only 10% of institutions that should be reporting are in fact reporting?
Right. I don't want to ask anything right now. Is there anything else either of you would ask? No. Okay, in that case, can we handle, we know that Minerals has to give an input, right? Can we go in the sequence that you spoke in, Treasury, SARS, etc.? Yeah, but let them answer the questions. Where's Treasury? Yeah. Mr. Momon had explained he's acting DG and had to go off to Tswane on an earlier flight.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't get as much question with regards to Treasury's involvement. As you are aware, our involvement is only on policy issues, and none of the questions that were asked relate to policy issues. Of course, let me say that where there's a need to change policy in order to deal with these issues, we're always ready to do that. Thank you, Chair.
We have a relationship with SARS. It's an oversight responsibility of the ministry. So in that sense, you'll say you're not a politician, but fine. It's just that we expect you to work closely with SARS. I mean, we're not living in another planet. We know the issues at the moment, right? But hey, SARS, and you must just abide by the law. Each of you's got no choice. You must just work in terms of the law. What are you supposed to do, right? So that's what we've told you in our report to Parliament adopted last week, right? So, my brother, I understand, but you do have a role. Yeah.
No, as far as those issues are concerned, Chair, we work together with SARS on police issues, of course. If we have to close down certain structures and where police intervention is required, we do work, actually, with all the agencies, finance family agencies that are here, not only SARS.
You know, Chair, National Treasury came in 2014 from a perspective that was almost suggesting that tax avoidance is not illegal. Now in the budget speech, it's now instructing SARS to deal with tax avoidance and transfer pricing. And those are policy issues.
Yeah, he's right, actually. Floyd, you're right. He's right, actually.
No, I thought the Honourable Member answered himself with regards to the questions that he asked. Because on the transfer pricing issue, questions that he asked. We have the rules already. We amended the legislation in order to allow SARS to exchange information on a country-by-country basis with other countries. And it's not limited to that. There's also an agreement of amendments that were made in the legislation to allow SARS to receive information from financial institutions, the so-called Common Reporting Standard, and that will... The exchange of information with regards to Common Reporting Standard will commence from the 1st of September. And with regards to the transfer pricing country by country reporting, the first files, as the Minister indicated in his budget speech, will commence from December 2017. So in as far as issues that you referred to, the transfer pricing issues, we have legislation and we have rules in the legislation to deal with that. And it's not limited to that. We also have rules that deal with anti-avoidance issues, such as control foreign companies, other structures such as hybrid mismatch arrangements, which are mentioned in the list of 15 BEPS action points. So, as I said at the beginning, where there is a need to intervene on the police side, we have sufficient capacity and always talk to the relevant regulators. Thank you.
It will be part of our, I think now that we're meeting 2 weeks from now, after that the three chairs will, over the constituency period, pull a document together. One of the issues we need to highlight is a point Floyd and others are making, which is this thing about, are we correct in saying this? Is this one of the things we want to, it'll be the, more something that falls within the finance committee. But this thing about, hey, it's legal to have tax avoidance, but it's illegal to have tax evasion. Well, for what it's worth, that Global Tax Transparency Conference also discussed that. And quite frankly, though they had all these technically sophisticated people, Floyd, frankly, I learned very little from that conference. Not that I know much. But they were discussing endlessly the same issue. The issue that will arise, Floyd, and others, is this. Hey, it's perfectly legitimate, it's creativity, the tax experts will lose their jobs, and, you know, Price Waterhouse and all were there, right? Then other people say it'll encourage disinvestment and all of that. So all of these issues came up. What happened at the end of the conference? Nobody, actually, frankly, apart from that statement that we adopted in the came up with an answer to that question. However, all they did was took their technical understanding forward. Hey, you know what? We're a developing country. We have obscene amounts of money disappearing. And an abysmal failure to deal with it, all of us collectively, not least the three committees here in Parliament as a whole. So we're not just blaming you. We're not doing our job, obviously. So what we are saying is, my brother, you tell Momo this. In any case, Zakele and Margo will do the report. One aspect that we're going to look at collectively, but particularly the Finance Committee, is to narrow the gap between so-called, what, tax avoidance and tax evasion. Okay? And really, I think when we must find the time to bring in Price Waterhouse, etc. here, and ask them, hey, maybe in your profession it's ethical, but what's moral, right, about what you are doing? Advising companies that are making huge amounts of profits on how not to pay the tax. Yet the free market system is about fair play, no state intervention. You know, let the market decide, as the DA would say, right, and so on. Now, basically, I'm not talking about Colin Eglin, obviously. Right. No, basically, what I'm trying to say is, my friend, that's what we want you to look at, right? That's one of the tasks. Is that agreed? That's one of the step forward. Right. Now, on that matter, because you see, if the chairs had our own way, we would have facilitated, not chaired, and told you, no, that falls under there. At the end of this, we must guide Zakele and Marco about how we're going forward. On this issue, it'll be couched carefully, Brandon. It'll say, National Treasury needs to carefully consider reducing the gap between what is currently devised as tax avoidance and what is tax evasion in a way that's consistent with ensuring that investment does not substantially decline on the one hand, and on the other hand, that people pay taxes where they make their profits. So we're not taking a decision, we do that. Then the committee will sit and discuss with them, don't come here next year, Minister of Finance, and tell us what tax proposals you're bringing. Parliament wants to propose some tax proposals to you. Right? Right. So now, Tandi, on the formulation along those lines, first let's hear Comrade.
David says the year after. Now, I'm saying on one good Sunday, can we have a workshop to discuss that specific issue? We grant National Treasury, because the policy matter, enough time to go back, because how Floyd might interpret tax avoidance might be a different meaning what the minister says. So
yeah.
On a good Sunday,
yeah. Yeah. Fine. We agree with you. Come
on. No, Chair, I think you first let me make that I have a family crisis, so that as I requested, that I have to attend to. But just quickly, unfortunately, we're not here to finalize some committee work that we do. The first thing I think to me, finally, that we have to look at is that what should be worrying is that there seem to be no comprehensive strategy of government on how to deal with this problem. And in the manner that is being done, we may reduce it into treasury when it may not necessarily. Treasury may be just an arm to use. And I think in the final analysis, we have to find that issue. And I think the disservice, I would have asked Mineral Resources to also make this presentation so that whilst we think that we're dealing with illicit financial flows, in essence we might be just dealing with tax issues. One part of this crisis is the impact of illegal mining as a contributor in the entire stream of illicit financial flows. And to the extent that we're not managing and dealing with that issue, we may address one part and leave one. And if you look in the magnitude of the cost implications, it becomes another issue. That so I'm just saying, whilst we deal with the main issue in relation to tax, illicit financial flows, if you reduce them to tax, you may not see the quantum of the actual problem to what extent it does. So I would have suggested that in as much as the DMR would have presented on the issue, they need to give in their presentation, even if it's not in writing, a background check on what is it that you can be able to deal with. So I thought I needed to flag this issue. Then I think what Tandi is saying in the final analysis, it will then give us an opportunity beyond what we have dealt with primarily now and look more on the entire challenge that we are faced with and narrow down the chain of activity so that we can deal with the actual problem in a manner that is not disintegrated. At this stage, I think there is a lot of where power lies, and this one, things that Sorenso is supposed to do, we need at the end of the day to arrive at a complementary exercise as to what has to be done. I just thought I needed to make that comment.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me preface my substantive remark I would wish to make by apologising to the meeting, because it would appear as if DTI were not informed that they had to make a presentation, so I would like to apologise for that. Thank you. But the substantive point I would like to make is that with respect to transfer pricing, with some of us calling base erosion and all kinds of other things, illicit financial flows, it's all the same thing. One of the issues that that came about through this was that with respect to tax specifically as such, which is an important source of income, it is arguably the greatest and the most significant source of income for the government. The challenge is that the adverse effect of multinationals' tax avoidance strategies on the national tax basis, and we don't often link transfer pricing to this. Tax avoidance, which is legal, it's legal, but yet it is directly linked to transfer pricing. The one facilitates the other as such. And I think that kind of thing has to be tackled. We have to take a decision, Chairperson, as to whether or not tax avoidance, as it currently covers a broad range of things, whether that should continue to cover this broad range, or whether the Finance Standing Committee, should not unpack some of this and say, no, 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 that's going to be regarded as evasion in future. In other words, let's be more specific on how to deal with that, Chair. And I really would like Finance to assist us in this regard. Thank you.
Okay, SAS, over to you. You got the drift, right? SAS?
Thank you, Chair. I'll just answer two questions. The first one was, do we read the newspaper? Yes, we do. If you go back to one of the largest settlements we ever had, one Dave King, several hundred million rand, that was triggered by one of our auditors reading the newspaper and noticing that what was reported there was not consistent with the lifestyle that had been reported to us. So, yes, we do read the newspaper. The second one was the question about what's the question in the ITR14 about, asking about adjustments in respect of transfer pricing. What we're dealing with there is an interaction between the income tax system and the customs. So what will often happen is, in order to get their transfer pricing right, a member of a multinational company will adjust the profit margin up or down. So they'll say, okay, according to our benchmarks, we've got too little profit in South Africa, we need to increase it. Or they may go the other way and say, we've got too much profit in South Africa, we need to decrease it. Now, transfer pricing on the income tax side is all about looking at that and making sure that that is correct. But if you've adjusted the profit margin and there was an import or export of goods involved, then, strictly speaking, you should be adjusting the price of those goods too. And that is what customs has been looking at, to make sure that the proper adjustments are made on both sides of the equation. And the reason we put the question in the tax return is to ensure that we get that flagged up for our review so that we can do that matching exercise and make sure that both sides are in sync. I'll hand over on the other question.
Just specifically, those figures you gave us, for which period are they? And secondly, you know, this issue keeps coming up, that SARS brings figures to the committee. We don't have the capacity to know how accurate they are. We're not saying you're deliberately misleading Parliament, but we don't have the capacity. We have to take your word for it. The other issue that obviously arises for all of us in some way, or most of us in some way or another, given the extent of the problem, although you were good in providing some detail, what you seem to be doing is far below what's necessary based on what we know to be the problem at its very minimal, and based on what we understand through the public domain and the anecdotal stuff and so on. So there's a huge gap between what you should be doing and what you are doing, is the way it comes across, at least to me.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may just respond to the years that we covered. So we looked at 2014 and 2015 specifically. When I presented, I mentioned that this is the first time perhaps that we look at this thing or this problem in the detail that we're looking at, and we did a test case to check how much the extent of this is in actual fact. So we've been speaking, or the committee has been reflecting on tax avoidance and tax evasion. So these are some of the methods that the clients out there will be a step ahead of us in utilizing the loopholes in the system to do exactly that. So at any time, we will be checking if there is compliance or non-compliance in any arena, and we will discover certain things. And how we arrived at this particular issue, it again was through the reading of newspapers. Okay. We read an article in the newspaper. It was referring to one of the clients of ours, and in reading that, we discovered that there could be an issue in that regard, and therefore we went deeper, and we discovered what we discovered. All right, and then in dealing with that problem, we started by checking just at the high, not the high level, but a few transactions across the sector to see the extent of the problem. Then going forward, we'll put more resources in dealing with the extent of that problem and make it a mainstream part of the activities of what we do going forward, Chairperson. And as I said, these are the things that, or the activities that our clients or clients out there will use to avoid taxes and do things like transfer pricing or do illicit financial flows. In responding to other questions, does SARS send its cases to different offices of SAPS and to who perhaps in SAPS as such? So our referrals to SAPS will happen in two ways. There are those that are handled at the central point, so we would have noticed certain behavior of clients, both from a tax and customs side, and would select those cases based on certain criteria to investigate further. And if we determine cases of blatant fraud, then from that particular unit that does that particular work, we will refer those cases directly to SAPS. And that's from a central point. The second part of it happens a little bit unstructured, in that in executing our work at points of entry or port of entry, we stumble across, and if you look at further the slides that I presented, I didn't get to get to that because of the time factor. There are statistics that shows exactly what we have done at port of entry, what we have stopped at port of entry, what we have discovered at port of entry, and what we have handed over to SAPS. So at those times that we detect that somebody has not declared the money accordingly as he was supposed to have declared to us, would take that case, deal with it from a customs perspective, and for further processing, we'll refer that to SAPS. And those are a bit decentralized, and we deal with them as and when we come across them at ports of entry. There was a question of the BMA. I would leave that to put as a policy matter to Treasury as well as other institutions that are dealing with the BMA, whether we are happy to let customs go to the BMA. I think that the policy matter, that's not something that SARS is busy with currently, or seized with currently. As I said earlier, the slides that I didn't cover, they also cover issues that relate to both currency, but in particular gold, as well as precious metals that certain clients or certain people attempted to take across the borders without having declared those to customs. And the customs law is quite clear. Anybody that crosses with goods needs to report those goods to customs. And we've referred those to SAPS. And as I said, the slides are quite clear as to where those cases are currently. Some of them are referred to, especially the currency, have been referred to SARB, and also the slides are clear as to what is happening with those cases. I'm not sure if I've covered all the questions.
My question really was with regard to the SARB and you and the advance payments. Is there now a system of reconciliation?
If I may respond to that, Chairperson, so what happens is we look at the import and export of goods. The money side of it, what happens is we receive information of the payment of those goods, either in or out, by various companies that would have done transactions across the border for purposes of importing goods or exporting goods. So we reconcile information that we receive from SARB on the finances specifically of financing those goods in terms of imports or exports, and we reconcile that with the goods that has been received or exported accordingly. Then the banks, in actual fact, have a limit of how long they require or they allow clients to export or to, let me say, pay money overseas for purposes of imports and for closing that transaction in the bank. What we have discovered is that there is no policing in the bank as to how people are dealing with that aspect. And that is the issue that we're dealing with here in terms of advance payments. We received that information, as I said, from SERB, and we reconcile that with the goods that has been received in South Africa or exported from South Africa, but there is a gap in terms of the bank itself in closing the transaction, in requiring the client that utilize the banking system to close that transaction in the banking system itself. And that is where the issue is. From now on, we'll be following up. That will become the mainstream activity in the activities in SARS. Thanks.
Next is FIC.
Thanks very much, Chair. There are a number of different questions here. Let me try and answer them to the best of my ability, and I might lean on my colleague here in doing that. Let me start off with Honourable Lisa's question around the reporting issues and capacity and the numbers that are involved here, the 9.5 million catch-all. I don't know if you can hear me. Let me say that is data that comes into the FIC in the form of reports, all sent in electronically and all processed electronically. And we have the IT systems into which we then feed rules, which would then process according to criteria and so on that we would develop based on the work that we're doing, the analysis we've been doing, the modus operandi of criminality, etc., so to be able to extract the data we need. We pay special attention to the STRs components of those reports because those have required human intervention on the side of the reporter, on the bank, whoever it is, and we're obligated to pay special attention as well on our side. So that's the process that happens. Going back to an earlier question, what then happens with referrals to law enforcement? Every law enforcement authority that we work with has a designated authorized officer, in other words, a nodal point with whom we then relate. So there's a pipe between the FIC and that particular entity. It might be the NPA, it might be SARS, it might be SAPS. And the information moves between those two points and nowhere else. It's then up to that law enforcement authority to distribute that referral, that information within it as an institution to whoever is then designated to deal with that particular matter, including the different units, for example, if we're talking about SAPS. So that's the process. You ask about the capacity in relation to processing the reports. We never have enough capacity, and I'm not being flippant, I think it's true. It's that we could always do that. Increasingly, we're working towards the ability to process huge volumes of data and work towards a kind of a big data analytic capability. And that's the vision, that's where we need to get to. Of course, there's a corollary to that as well, in that our partners, be it in law enforcement or be it in the supervisory bodies, also need to have the capacity to receive the stuff and to do something with it. So it's to make sure that the value chain as a whole is fully capacitated. It doesn't help that one or two links in that chain have more or less. We need to make sure that there's an evenness distributed throughout the system for the system to become successful. There was then a reference, I think, in one of your questions to the fact that I think it's also partly Honourable Boudelaise was speaking about silos. And when we relate this to the value chain, we can also then see that the joined upness that's required is not there, or it's not there to the extent it needs to be there in order to make sure that there's a success in the referrals that we make. That's what we've been discussing today. We know that. So certainly one of the things that we've been looking at is how to become part of joint working groups, task teams to focus on certain areas, and that would be law enforcement and the FIC in this instance. I'm going to switch here. In all of that, we will pick up and we'll find gaps on the regulatory side, the policy, regulatory, legislative side. And so that we also need to make sure that when we're dealing with the law enforcement or the investigative side, we need to match and align it with what exists in the policy, and where there are gaps, we can then begin to plug those gaps. One of the, what I think is a very exciting possibility that starts opening up, and we don't have the law available at this point to do it, but is to bring the private sector or the main reporters of the private sector into a closer relationship with law enforcement or with the supervisors or and with the policymakers, so that actually we start a proper round table approach to many of the financial crime problems that we face. That's something which is being experimented with in other countries. At this point in time, the Australians have just launched a new platform where they start exploring this in depth, and they're probably ahead of the curve internationally, but it brings all the different agencies together at an operational level to deal with these issues. Policymakers then hover around it in order to understand where there are still problems. So I think that if we were to tackle the problem of financial crime efficiently and effectively and have real impact, that's probably where we need to go, and we need to do that sooner rather than later. Now, there was a question relating to the Anti-Money Laundering Council, the Counter-Money Laundering Council, which in the proposed FIC bill, or the bill, has been disbanded. It's to go down precisely this road, that at an operational level, the relevant parties can meet and can engage on these things, rather than sit in an ivory tower, which was the problem before, at a high policy level, and have no impact whatsoever. So that's the orientation, and that's where this must go. And once the bill has gone through, the minister will then announce a process and regulate for that at the operational level. Moving on then to Honourable Buthelezi, you spoke about, you asked about the Panama Papers and why there is no illegality. We, using the FIC Act and compliance with the Act, subjected those names that had emerged publicly to FIC compliance inspections, and no non-compliance was found. That's what falls directly under our jurisdiction as the FIC. I can't talk, quite honestly, and I'm not ducking the issue here, whether there has been tax evasion or not, or any other kind of criminality which might fall under one of my partners here's a responsibility. But I think, again, just to emphasize that, 2 points, that the mere fact of having an account offshore is not in and of itself criminality, but it does beg the question, why do you want to go and open an account there? Right. So it certainly raises a serious red flag, and it means that we've got to find a way of getting to the bottom of that. The ability to do that is severely constrained. Which then brings me to Honourable Shivambu's question around the HSBC matters. We're aware of that, and it goes back to this earlier point I've just made. We've been engaged with the Swiss authorities, my colleagues in what's called the EMRAS in Switzerland, to access that information. But up until recently, the Swiss banking laws, secrecy laws, and the tax haven status that it's held has meant that there's very little forthcoming. We've been in discussions with them. There's an MOU, which is now in the process of being finalized, in order to be able to access all of that. I'm hoping it's going to be able to do that, but it's probably not sufficient. So we live in an uneven the playing ground here. On the issue, Honourable Manier, of registered entities and reporting entities, that's not an unusual equation at all. The 34,000 that are registered, firstly, that number will vary from year to year. So when we're in good years and people open up businesses within the categories that have to register, that will increase. When there's a recession or something goes wrong, it'll shrink. And we'll see it, for example, in the state agency category. My mother decides this is a bit of an additional income, she can make a buck, she opens up a thing and she works on a Sunday for a year or two, suddenly there's no longer any property being sold, she deregisters and walks away from it. So that's the increase and subsidence of those numbers. But in excess of 95%, and I think I'm right, of the reporting to the FIC comes from the financial sector and the big banks in particular. So the others report from time to time, but it's a small number. That's not to say that they are avoiding reporting. I think that we might have a problem with awareness of the responsibilities, the extent of the diligence that they would be applying in that context, and we could all probably do more in trying to raise that compliance awareness and so on. But it's not unusual at all. And I'm comparing myself now to, or us as FIC and the country, to other countries. Going back to Honourable Lees's question then of the numbers of reports that come in, as a financial intelligence unit in a generic sense, the FIC receives a lot more data than many other countries because of the way we've been structured, but also the way we've implemented and applied this. And we also make far more referrals to law enforcement than others do, than many, many others do. They're quite a few ahead of us, but we're right there in the top. There was then a subsidiary question around why the low number of referrals in the past year, the 511, Honourable Manu, you asked. And that is a consequence of lack of capacity. Now, and again, there's a very simple reason, in the sense that we're finding ourselves in the FIC having to do far more analytic work for law enforcement authorities across the board, because there's also a lack of capacity on that side, or lack of ability to work with this information. And so we're being requested and we're having to shoulder a lot of that responsibility and spending a lot more time and effort in providing a product which needs minimal work on the other side of the equation, which then draws us away from the ability to dig deep into, or rather to process more and larger numbers. So it's getting a balance between these things on a continuous basis. And again, if there was more money in the fiscus and no fingers pointing to anybody, if we had more money in the country and there was growth, et cetera, we'd probably have the ability to raise the bar all round on this one. Chair, I think I've covered the points, maybe a bit haphazardly, but all the points asked of the FIC at this stage. Thank you.
For those who are not here, the chairperson of Trade Industry explained that something happened with the committee secretary on the trade industry side, right? But at 12:51 on Thursday, the documentation was sent to our committee secretary, forward to your committee secretary. But bearing that in mind, we still want you to respond. On the issue about your preparedness, we understand. It's not fair on you, but the chairperson's explained what happened here.
Okay. Yes, I can just respond, I think, on three questions that were raised here. In fact, the first question was on this issue of beneficial owners, the disclosure of beneficial owners. The Honourable Member raised a concern that this issue, this disclosure maybe might not be as spontaneous as it has to be, because normally annual returns are filed once in a year. And on that one, I do concede that according to the system that we have, according to the policy that we have, that disclosure is only done on the annual financial returns. But we will see to it that and maybe look into it in detail as to the spontaneous maybe an agency of it, especially when it comes to change of directors, that maybe when a person is changing, when there is a filing of the change of directors, there has to be maybe some similar disclosures. But that is a policy issue that we can rectify and look into that. Then the other issue was about regulatory burden.
in that we make sure that we make in our legislation there is no regulatory burden involved, because it is just a disclosure in a form that these are the beneficial owners, I am the nominee, these are the beneficial owners, just so it is just on that form. So we took to it that at least we must fall within the policy, the policy intent of the legislation, that we want to reduce regulatory burden at all costs. So there is no regulatory burden on that one. So when it comes to the question of the next honorable member on the list of international agreements that deal with illicit financial flows and which agreements are there and which ones have we adhered to and how are we enforcing them. So it's very, very difficult from this point to come up with a list of all the international agreements. But we can, since we initially we came here as observer, but when we next time when we can go and do a research, we can go and just extract on our information sources, just to come with a precise list of international agreements and which ones are relevant to this and what are they doing. We do have a unit that monitors international agreements, which is an international trade and development unit. They can assist. We do have that information. So when it comes to this issue of enforcing illegal gambling, when it comes to online gambling, what we did is that from a policy level perspective, in fact, there are countries that have already legalized online gambling. But we are the country that are strict on it to say that unless if maybe there is a mechanism in place, we cannot legalize that. So the way in which we are enforcing is that there are servers that are, we find that maybe there is in a gambling, people maybe are gambling against a server that is inside the country, or maybe another website, maybe another server that is somewhere. So those servers, at least from the legal point of view, they are illegal. So if maybe they are found out and investigations take place, maybe SAPS and other law enforcement agencies can confiscate those servers and punish the perpetrators accordingly. But when it comes to foreign servers, where we don't have any jurisdiction, what happens is that there are interactions with the Reserve Bank that at least those winnings or those illicit financial flows must some way be blocked before they arrive in the country. In fact, those illegal gamblers must at least make sure, in fact, they must at least be aware that that kind of activity is illegal and that they mustn't benefit from that illegal activity. So they may forfeit even their winnings in this regard. So that is what all that I can say. Just that we could have come with a comprehensive presentation.
Yeah. Documentation was sent 2.5 weeks ago, right? But that's a matter between you and the committee secretary. NPA.
Chair, I think there was only two questions that I needed to respond to, but please remind me if I missed something. I think the one was about the huge cash deposits into bank accounts. I think the problem there is traditionally policy is focused on the financial institution needing to know their customer. But if somebody else comes to pay money into the account of their customer, there's nothing in law that requires them to know who that person is. It's simply a person. You know, it could be a person from a... Yeah. So I think it is an area where we may want to look at possible law reform. And in this case, as I said, it is very huge cash deposits that were made. Given we live in a cash economy, there are big businesses that run on cash, but we do think that this is an area that needs serious... Let me say that I've been in the money laundering trade for a long time, but it really is recently the first time that we have seen this kind of phenomenon. And I've not read about it in the literature previously in other countries and so on. So it is something that has sort of come to our attention recently, that probably should have come to our attention earlier, but I think it is a gap that there is that needs legislative attention. You know, there's nothing that requires, or regulatory attention perhaps, but the problem is that the focus has been on the know your customer, not on the knowing the people who may deal with your customer.
Almost surrealistic about it. Laughable, actually. So I can, I'm a net bank client, so I can deposit, well, when will I ever have 2 million? Let's say whatever figure is appropriate for a chair of a committee, right? No, I'm a fat cat, but I'm not a, I don't have any business interest. So what is a chair? And 45, how much would you take? 49, I think, right? So, hey, yeah, okay. I see that. It's shocking, actually, this is like, you know. What are your people doing, all of you? You also, besides, you know, you weren't born in 1994, right? You come from before that. I all of you, I should answer that question. It's stunning. And Tandi, can you explain? You're always raising these issues. How come you haven't picked it up? It's a rhetorical question.
No,
you won't be able to give a good answer. Can we move on?
No, but Chair.
The chairperson rules himself out of order. The chairperson's out of order. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. I think the second issue has to deal with the big retailers. And I'm going to use an example because I don't want to talk about the exact case we're talking about. But somebody walks into a major retailer, buys very expensive plasma screens and 50, 80,000 a shot, and buys 20 of them. That is a lot of money. And they pay with cash, not through any other method. Again, it's a kind of regulatory gap there. Somebody's receiving a huge amount of cash from a person that is not known to them, but there's nothing that says you must know the people that buy from you. So I think there's not necessarily easy answers here, but this is partly the method that was used. So for example, you can go and buy, I think, what's called a prepaid credit card. So you buy a card that's loaded with R500,000 of credit on it, or more, and you take it out of the country and give it to somebody, and they spend it in another country. So essentially, you've remove the money from the country with none of the normal oversight mechanisms working. And I think it is partly because of these new kind of negotiable instruments that are developing that, you know, law enforcement is in our regulatory environment needs to catch up with it. And that's, I think, why we are bringing it to this committee. It is gaps that need to be closed.
Okay, once again,
I had one other question. Oh. I think there was the case of the person who had benefited from many hundreds of millions of rands. I think she has at least been convicted now of bribing a Reserve Bank official, or trying to bribe a Reserve Bank official. So that case at least has been dealt with as a good news story.
Mr. Chairman, just the question of family trust?
Yeah, of course, that was a legitimate question. In the sense, not legally legitimate, but I withdraw that. I'm out of order, right? Okay.
I think the issues of trusts, family trusts, I mean, just as a generic name, but they can set up incredibly complicated ownership structures of one trust owning another trust, of having shares or parts of another trust. And it has become a way, because it's not easy to trace the assets unless you physically find a property that's registered in the name of a trust. You know, with motor cars, you can type in an ID number and you can find the cars that are registered in a person's name. If a trust has bought a car, it's a different story. And if there are trusts that you don't even know the names that you need to look for, you know, I think that's where the gap is at the moment. And because those records are not electronically searchable, you know, you can't search on names, you can't search on ID numbers, on addresses, on anything. It's heaps and heaps of papers in the offices of the various masters, and there are 9 of them. So it's not even that you can go to one office to look at it. So I think it is a major area. It's not going to be an easy issue to tackle. But it is vital if we are going to deal with
you know, with attempts to remove money from scrutiny.
Okay, sorry, once again to Minerals. Can you come in now? You have 10 minutes or more. Your original input, please, and then we'll take questions flowing from your input only. Sorry? Ah, yes, Saab, is there anything you want to say? Yeah, you were put questions to, sorry, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
You love congratulating
you. Two awkward ones, I'll answer them first, I think. The obviously, our brief when we came here was to deal with the more high-level issues. On the VR Asia, Laser Asia matter, I would risk not telling you the truth if I give you an update on that situation. I need to go and find the actual detail. If I don't know if I can get away with that. The second question on the compliance with the FICA and the Banks Act, we represent the Financial Surveillance Department. The department responsible for compliance with the Banks Act and FICA would be our Bank Supervision Department. So I'm not in a position to respond on their behalf. But obviously, if a question is directed to them or to the Register of Banks, I'm sure they would be in a position. The advance payments, SARS and the SAR position, I think what we do is obviously we have the cross-border transaction records, which shows when an advance payment was made. That is monitored against the data received from SARS on when the goods were cleared. Obviously, in terms of the regulations, you don't have to clear the goods on the same day that you pay. There's a four-month, the accessory regulations allow you a four-month gap between the payment and the receipt. There's a process in place to follow up the outstanding goods with the authorized dealers or the banks. We also provide the cross-border transaction records to SARS. They obviously have a mandate to look after issues that we're not looking after, like duties and income tax. But there's definitely a process in place, and we are monitoring as far as possible these flows. And many of the cases that I'm referring to originated from this monitoring process. We also, on request, provide SARS with information, if necessary, under oath, on actual transactions that can be used in their cases. There was a question on the blocking orders. The actual blocking orders, it's approximately 145 million. I think the question was based on a 5 to 8 billion. It's actually, the amount blocked was 145 million. The blocking order is just one of the steps in the process when you investigate an illicit cross-border transaction. That is to stop further flows and to try and recover the money that's already left in an illegal manner. We are taking these matters, and those are the cases we are now referring to solve for criminal prosecution, because contravening the exchange control regulations is still a criminal offence. But these cases, in many instances, involve the falsification of documentation, and I'm talking not only the documents relating to the cross-border transaction, but in some cases using false identities. These matters are then referred for criminal prosecution, because we do not have the power to do any criminal investigation or prosecution. Changing the strategy, I think that relates to that cases where we find that with substantial amounts exited illegally, false documentation, even though we have seized some assets or money, are now referred as a sort of standard approach for criminal prosecution. And we do have, in many of the cases, already have case numbers. There's just a process to get the information as to the progress in the investigations. But we have case numbers in a number of the cases already. But we need to, and I think that the joint action group that's been referred to may assist us in resolving these issues as to where to lay a charge, who to talk to. That's a bit of an issue that we still have to clarify. But we do have in many of the cases actual case numbers. Whether the investigations are progressing, I'm not in a position to tell you, because we need to get feedback from the authorities, law enforcement, on that. I think I've covered all the questions. I don't know if there's anything that I've missed.
very quickly, please.
Just on the
I'm worried about managing time. So how many other people have asked questions? Sorry?
1 second, it's just a follow-up. I mean, I completely understand that the FICA matter falls outside your department in the bank's supervision department, but the VRM laser investigation, according to your own correspondence, falls squarely within your department. Could I, through you, Chair, ask if the presenter could, like the Hawks member, just step outside, get the relevant details, and provide the relevant details to this committee? It's of enormous public importance that we know whether this matter is being investigated, whether the investigation has been completed, and what the outcome of that investigation is. Thank you.
Well, there's a lunch break for half an hour. Maybe you can attend to it then.
We'll
consider
the
position. Okay, and I notice our friend is here from, but there's going to be a lot of issues. So can't we, because it's not fair to Minerals, can we have Minerals, please, 10 minutes or thereabouts?
Good day, Honorable Chairpersons and Honorable Members. My name is Joel Rapela. I'm from the Department of Mineral Resources. And there's a short presentation that we will take Honorable Members through. And in the interest of time, I'll just highlight the most important aspects so that I don't repeat what colleagues from other state entities had taken us through. Can we go to the set? Yes. So that is a short outline of the presentation that we wanted to focus on. I think there are copies being circulated. On to the next slide. We recognize as a department that base erosion and profit sharing pose one of the risks to realizing the true value from the exploitation of the resources, mineral resources that we have in the country. Various reports that have been commissioned both at the level of the AU, including those released last year through UNCTAD, further confirm and amplify the magnitude of the challenge that we are faced with pertaining to base erosion and profit shifting. Essentially, it undermines the national economic sovereignty of the country and erodes the socioeconomic developmental impact that we can realize through full potential of exploitation of our resources. Complex as it is, a solution to this problem needs to be found, but it requires a multidisciplinary approach, hence the presentations by various government agencies in this regard, as well as a collaboration of working together with the private sector. In respect of mining, the MPR is a principal act necessary to regulate the orderly exploitation of mineral and upstream petroleum resources in the country. One area that we have identified is the structuring of transactions that often undermine transformation, and in this case, through mechanisms such as the transfer pricing and the announcements by Minister of Finance and Government in curbing this transfer pricing will greatly assist so that we can address the challenge of base erosion and profit shifting. The work that we continue to do with other agencies such as SARS and the National Treasury and others in addressing the challenge of BEPS, as it's commonly known, is starting to bear some fruit. And statistics that have been reported on here pertaining to some of the companies that are currently subjects of various audits is an indication of the impact of the work that has been done in this regard. Within the mining industry also, there's a framework agreement for a sustainable mining industry that contains one of the objectives, the focus on addressing transfer mispricing, which is an inherent base erosion and profit shifting. But what is also important are what are the interventions, and the next slide, what are the key interventions that have been put in place amongst others to address this challenge? On our side, recognizing the complications of the challenge of BEPS, we're working very close with South African Bureau of Standards as well as SAR, aimed at strengthening on the verification of the quality and quantity of minerals that are being exported to ensure that the right values of minerals that are exported clearly reflect that which has been mined or produced in the country, so that the declarations that we have both at the level of the department and SARS are able to talk to each other. So that is one area that we're working on. And also, as a department, we have engaged SABS to utilize its expertise with the view of developing what you may call a quality assurance mechanism for minerals that are destined for export. And that is to ensure that we are able to balance the books, if I were to put those words, in terms of what is being mined and what is being exported. We are in the process of reviewing the mining charter, and areas of transfer pricing has an impact on undermining transformation. And one of the interventions that has been identified in the reviewing of the mining charter is to ensure that black shareholders also are able to participate in the marketing and trading of minerals, so that value can also accrue to those who are meant to benefit from transformation. Through ongoing work, as and when companies are required to submit their monthly returns accounting for production, we continue to investigate as and when we pick up cases of what we call under-invoicing by producers, which would indicate areas where we think the under-invoice or under-declare some of the minerals that they are producing. The other area that is of importance, which needs to be reflected on, and as Honorable Chair was highlighting earlier on, relates to illegal mining and the impact that it has on creating problematic markets which are not part of your legal framework. Some of the studies that were conducted, for example, last year, indicate that for precious metals alone, in excess of 7 billion rand was lost through illegal mining proceeds. And we think that this is an area that needs to be looked at for purpose of ensuring that we don't end up with value being eroded from our fiscals in the country. And this also requires us as collective, as various government agencies, to work together to ensure that we can root out this challenge. The other one is around perhaps as a country really beginning to think through better regulation or handling the trading of minerals that are being produced in South Africa, and drawing lessons from other countries such as Australia that have started to realize value through approaching how trading of their minerals and where their trading houses are being located is starting to benefit them as a country. The next slide. These are just the elements of what we are intending to do as part of the MOU or working together with SARS and other agencies. We can move on to the next slide because the detail. I indicated earlier on that we have a framework agreement for a sustainable mining industry, which is a social compact between various stakeholders, government, organized business, and as well as organized labor. And one of the areas that has been highlighted or is a priority in this framework agreement relates to transfer pricing. And a presentation was done there by SARS outlining the work, as was also highlighted today in this meeting, that it is doing with regard to combating base erosion and profit sharing. The presentation, in summary, highlighted that there's a significant transfer pricing that's taking place within the extractive industry, amongst others. And the work that they presented today in the summary form, the statistics, clearly speak to work that they have been doing, so they are doing as SARS aimed at addressing this challenge. And key recommendations from that study, one was that SARS needs to continue the work with World Bank to create the necessary audit guidelines to assist auditors to identify and audit transfer pricing in the mining industry, and as well as build the necessary capacity to deal with large business taxpayers that are equipped to engage in the complexities of transfer pricing. Then In conclusion, as I had indicated earlier on, transfer pricing is really a challenge that undermines the national economic sovereignty of South Africa. And although the extent is not quantified, but the figures that continue to be mentioned here clearly indicate the magnitude of the challenge that we are faced with. We will emphasize that the marketing of South Africa's minerals is currently largely externalized, and I think it's one of the areas that has to be looked at. And ask the question whether perhaps it isn't the time right for government to initiate a process of looking at the relocalization of strategic decisions at a country level, you're starting to see the impact. On our side as a department, links to areas such as your or under invoicing, we continue to also call on mining companies to desist from engaging in exercises that lead to BEPS, because that really undermines national economic sovereignty. And with regard to illegal mining and others, there's also a need, and the discussion earlier this morning emphasized the importance of exploring appropriate legislative instruments to secure, amongst others, the localization of these minerals, as well as the trading, so that we can realize true value from the extractive products in our country. That is our short report. Thank you.
Thanks. Questions? Sipisa? Brandon? John, obviously, you're coming. Bongani, Mr. Mania.
Thank you, Chair. There is no doubt that there is a lot of this illegality taking place in the mining sector. just to share with the presenter, we attended a meeting about this illicit financial flows a few weeks ago as members of the Standing Committee on Finance. One of the things that we were told, and I would like to hear your comment, is that there is a lot of fake metals exportation. I'll tell you what we mean about that. That where, for instance, you are more expensive metals, like a diamond or perhaps and gold, can be, let's say, tin-plated. And then you think that you are exporting tin, whereas you are exporting gold. The point which was made there was that the technology and the capacity that we're having at the ports is not able to detect that. I would like to hear your experience as far as that is concerned. But taking the strategic nature of our minerals, I think we need to. I've heard some of the stakeholders who have got insight as to what is exactly happening there, and they've got very interesting experiences that they would love to share with us, Chair. I think we should also look at perhaps a forum where we can listen to them. People who are involved in the industry itself, and we listen to them, because there's a lot of our money which is going out from this sector, which is very strategic, leading to this very high unemployment that we find, for instance, in the mining sector. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand this problem. By definition, and France can correct me if I'm wrong, transfer pricing can only occur between connected parties. Right. So most of our mines, from my understanding, are already South African, and therefore they're not dealing with a connected party. But let's presume that it is there. How do they do transfer pricing? I mean, you're basically exporting a commodity with a basic mineral price that's pretty much market related. So any massive change which is not within market range will be easily potentially red flagged as a transfer pricing adjustment requirement. Am I missing something? Because it sounds to me always like this transfer pricing has been made such a boogeyman. We've got lots of good tax rules against transfer pricing.
So the legislation is there to stop transfer pricing from being a problem. So how is it happening specifically in the mining industry, other than adjusted? Because there's not big royalty adjust payments that can be made. There can't be big IT or know-how charges levied against the mining. I don't understand how it's happening.
You next, Bongani.
No, thank you very much, President. I want to also focus on the matters of transfer pricing in relation to tax avoidance. I think we had the colloquium in 2015 and we had a report about that from the trading industry, and these issues were reported as such. One of the companies, mining companies that was listed there was Lonmin and other companies, NUMSA and SAMDA, they've reported misgivings about that. Now, the Department of Mineral Resources is telling us that they are calling. They are not telling us that they are intervening to that. So what actions since 2015, after the report in May, have you made practical steps to make sure that you stop this thing? Because there are companies that are listed that are accused of doing this. One of them is Lonmin. So how far are you with that particular process? Because there are, by the way, companies in South Africa that are doing transfer pricing, you know, misreporting, you know, reducing profits and so forth in order to confuse their accountability in terms of taxation in South Africa. So that mandate is with the departments. So how far? Not calling, you make a call for a boycott, but the issue, what practical steps did you do to make sure that we get rid of this?
Next. Right, that's it. Okay. Can we adjourn for lunch? We're back. It's now 1:33. We'll be back at 2:00.
And then we'll have replies from DTI.